Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 20th, 2020, and welcome to episode 222 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to us? Will I ever find
the RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and twos, apparently, this time. I am Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined by three retro computing enthusiasts today. Clockwise on my screen, I see Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
Excellent. I see you too.
Yes, counterclockwise from you. Clockwise from Carrington, we have Quinn Dunkey from Los Angeles. How are you?
I'm very good. I mean, I'm not from here, but I am presently here, so yeah.
Fair enough.
Call that an intro.
Okay. Continuing clockwise, we have Jack Nutting in Sweden. How are you?
I'm good.
In Stockholm, even.
In Stockholm city limits.
Yes. There. I've successfully gotten us past all of this without talking about the weather at all.
We did.
Very nice.
It's like a miracle.
My weather app just says smoke now.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, I suppose, right.
It's terrible. The whole left half of the country is on fire.
We can see it from the right half of the country.
It's pretty awful.
Yeah, it's not good.
And no longer do we have to worry about melting over here anyway. It's no longer hot. It's not even close to hot anymore.
It was actually really cold here one day last week because the smoke was literally blocking out the sun. It's like, well, that can't be good. Isn't that what happened to the dinosaurs?
Turned out great for them.
Yeah. How'd that work out?
So, we have wound up on an episode full of twos. It is, as I will remind you, September 20th of 2020, episode 222. And so we thought about this a little bit, like what would be an appropriate topic. And Quinn came up with the idea of talking about our second computer, what we learned and improved on after having learned the lessons from our first computers. We can just sort of go around and think about that. I mean, like what our second computers were and why they were that and what we wished they would have been or whatever. Carrington, I see you still clockwise from me, so I will pick on you first.
Oh, move around. I don't have a great story for my second computer other than, in typical me fashion, I thought it was one thing for the longest time, and I just don't know what I'm talking about. So for ages, I referred to my second computer as a Heathkit computer because it was a kit computer I got from a neighbor of mine. First one was an Altair that was basically put together. I finished kind of putting it together, and my second computer came from somebody down the opposite side, the opposite end of the street, and they had a kit computer. They had sort of begun to put together, and they thought they had all of the parts, and then I got gifted that. Well, I got it through a garage sale, but I think it was like $2 or something. It was like essentially a nothing thing. And for years and years and years, I referred to that as a Heathkit computer, and I think it's because there was this long time in my life where I thought Heathkit just meant kit. It's got kit in it. I don't care if it's a brand. If it's a kit computer, it's a Heathkit.
That's like Hoover or Kleenex.
Yeah, I don't know why I thought that. It was a while ago I realized it wasn't a Heathkit because I went searching for an image of what the computer was. I think it was like an S100 bus thing. It wasn't what I considered a real computer. My first real computer was the Model 1. To me, it looked like what I thought a computer should be, have a keyboard and stuff. This was another one of those. It's a computer in name, but as a kid, I was like, this doesn't look like what they look like in movies. It's not real. So I didn't actually like it that much, to be honest. So I had it. So that's my second computer. I did almost almost nothing with it. I don't know what it is. I've looked, done tons of kit computers and looked for like late 1970s kit computers and looked at tons of images on Google. I tried again for the show. I don't know. It was some sort of kit. Maybe it was a local Toronto thing. I have no idea. So if you lived near my family in the like around 1978, 79, I guess it would have been, I don't know, something like late 1970s, and you had a garage sale and gave away a barely begun kit computer to a little kid who had a lot more hair than this big kid does, then maybe you know what my second computer was, and you can email the show. Otherwise, I don't know. It was a kit computer. I mostly assembled it. I'm not even sure if I got it done correctly. I did almost nothing with it, and then it was only onwards and upwards from there. Second computers suck. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. It's like Star Trek movies or whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly. Nobody likes the sequel. So that's the story. Don't know what it really was, but it was a kit computer of some sort.
Yeah. Not even sure what the story really was.
It was a Heath kit. That's what I'm saying. I'm going to go back to it. It's so much easier to say. It was a Heath kit. What model? Don't ask so many questions. I thought we were going to do two's compliment. No, I'm kidding. I want to change the topic.
All right.
Actually, I do not want to change the topic to two's compliment.
All right. Well, Quinn, this was your
fault.
Thought. Did you actually have some things you learned from your first computer, or do you also not know what it was?
I do have some things I learned. The first thing I learned is that when Carrington warns you about a story being stupid, you should listen to him. Luckily, I do have actually a better story than that for my second computer.
Hard not to.
Yeah, it's a low bar. Our first computer was an Apple II Plus, which I seem to recall we paid $3,500 Canadian for, I want to say, which was like in 1981 dollars or something, just an obscene amount of money. And then, of course, there was a bunch of assembly required, and it was a whole big thing. And then after all that, it kind of did nothing. And, you know, that was the experience. But we learned a lot from that. First, we kind of bought, I think, I don't remember what year it was exactly, but it was kind of at the tail end of the 2 Plus. And so we almost immediately were wishing we'd bought a 2E. So that was one thing, you know, that was our first lesson in the obsolescence curve, because we couldn't run, especially a lot of the games. I wanted to run King's Quest and all these other things that needed 128K and double high res, and couldn't run any of that stuff. And so that was one learning. And the second learning was that Apples are really expensive. So our second computer was a Laser 128EX. And this entire topic was just my scheme to talk about that machine, because I feel like Apple people don't spend enough time talking about lasers and how great they were. This thing, I think most of us probably know the story of how they did a clean room, whatever, reverse engineering of the ROMs. And so they didn't have the Franklin problem, as it were. But the 128EX in particular was really an amazing machine. It had the form factor of the 2C, except it also had a numeric keypad. It had a row of function keys, which were actually all mapped to control keys. So I think like F3 was control C, etc. So you could very quickly learn what the function keys did in every program. So it was kind of like function keys that were automatically supported in all software, which was such a good idea. And it had the accelerator in it, which was sort of adorable because it was not cleverly designed the way the 2C Plus accelerator was. It literally just overclocked it. And somehow they still made the disk work, but everything else was just overclocked. So all of the sound was played too fast, and everything ran too fast. The serial ports were wonky. Like, it just, nothing, the whole machine got less stable, which was really funny. So there was a 1 megahertz, a 2, and a 3 megahertz setting. The highest was 3.6 megahertz. And I never found any software that ran for more than a couple of minutes on the 3.6 megahertz setting. Even easy, basic stuff like AppleWorks or whatever, it would all crash pretty quickly. So that setting was useless. The middle setting of 2.4 was pretty stable. I ran Geos in 2.4, and that was stable for several hours at a time. So it was usable there. But it was, I don't know, it was a cool idea anyway, and it was certainly useful in its way. And yeah, great form factor. The other thing that I loved about it is that it had an external slot on it, which was also such a good idea. So literally there was just, you know, one of those great big card edge connectors that you'd see inside an Apple II Plus sticking out the side of it, and you could stick cards directly outside of the machine. It was intended for an expansion box. You know, they had one of those like similar to the Mountain Computer box that you were supposed to plug in with a ribbon cable, but you could literally just stick a card in there And I ran a Ram Factor card in there for quite a while. It's just floating precariously in space, hanging off the card edge. And that actually worked really well. Until later, I learned that actually there's memory expansion inside the machine, yet another great design feature of this thing. So if you took the cover off, there was unpopulated RAM chips in there. And if you populated them, amazingly, it used the same chips that the Ram Factor did. So I literally just pulled the chips off my Ram Factor and stuck them inside the laser. And it gave you like a ProDOS RAM disk of however many, you know, Ks or megabytes or whatever that worked out to. So so I used that for downloading very legal software from bulletin boards because it was a great kind of holding area so that you could, you know, download the shrinkets or whatever and unpack them onto the floppies. And I absolutely loved that machine. Every inch of it was so much better designed than the Apple IIc at the time. So, it's also rumored to be the machine that triggered Apple to make the 2C Plus because they were so worried about it because it was so much obviously better than the 2C and it was like a third of the price or something. So, that was my second computer and I loved it and I still have it. It's in a box in my parents' basement.
Wow.
Very cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, I knew some of those things about it. Not your specific machine, but that one. And I guess I hadn't put all the pieces together in my mind. It does sound quite good, actually. It is hilarious, this little card hanging off the edge.
Yeah, that was precarious. Amazingly, I managed to never set a drink on it and break it off. The other feature about it I loved also is it had a color killer switch on the front. So there was the 4080 switch like 2C had, and there was a couple other switches, and one of them was a color killer. And so for something like GEOS, that was incredible because GEOS on a color monitor was relatively unusable. Everything was just, you know, blurry from the double high res, black on white. And so you just flip that switch and presto, it looked great. So it turned it into a kind of a Macintosh for a lot less money. So just so many little things like that all over that machine that were really great.
Didn't they make, once the 2C Plus came out, didn't they make a subsequent laser that sort of modeled that too?
Yeah, there was the 128, the 128 EX, which I had, and then the 128 EX2. And for the EX2 had the 3.5-inch drive, so yeah, it was supposed to be superior to the 2C Plus. I don't know a whole lot about that machine.
Mm-hmm. And of course, if Apple had made it, there would be subsequent to that an EX2S.
Exactly. And an SE.
Yeah. Excellent. Jack, what about your second computer?
Yeah, so I guess I should start with my first computer because it's directly related. So my first computer was, as I've said before, an Atari 400, which everyone knows had the terrible keyboard and low RAM and stuff. But over the course of the first year or two that I had that, I maxed out the RAM with a third-party add-on, and I also bought a third-party replacement keyboard. So you can just rip out the membrane thingy, and by that time it was fine. It was a nice keyboard. So, but I bought this in my first computer I bought in 1983, and I was very like money constrained was kind of why I chose that over the 800, say, just because no one else in my family had an interest in this. There was no one kind of, you know, promoting this. I mean, I got some money from my parents and that kind of thing, but it was mostly a matter of me trying to scrounge my pennies to save up for this thing. So anyway, I bought that. I used it, upgraded it as far as I could. And a few years later, Atari had come out with their second wave of 8-bit machines. The 1200, 600, 800 XL all came out around the time that I bought my 400. And that was fine. You know, I had some friends who had those kind of things. A few years later, they had the XE line, which is the 65 XE and 130 XE. And I was like, oh, man, that's great. And I actually saved up and bought the 130 XE. So now by this time, this is after the Macintosh had come out and both the Atari ST and Amiga had come out. But all of these things were still, they were way beyond what I could imagine paying for anything like this. And so I bought the 130 XE, and that was, I mean, I was also familiar with it, and I had all the peripherals and software and everything. And for me, the biggest thing was that I kept the 400, so I had both. And so for a while, I could do the awesome thing of downloading highly legal software from BBSs on one computer and playing highly legal games on the other computer. And it was great. And like, and the 130 XE did have nice things, like Quinn mentioned with your second computer. The 130 XE had 128K of RAM, so you could use that whole upper 64K as a big RAM disk, all that kind of thing. So it was a nicer machine to use in that way, that you had it had some additional features. And also it had things like a monitor port, which the 400 never had. It had an external expansion for I think there were some RAM expansions, and also there were like some hard drive solutions that could plug into that, but I couldn't afford that at the time either. So like in retrospect, it was an upgrade in certain ways, but in other ways, not that much. Like if you think about it, you know, a computer that came out in 1979 and then a computer that came out in 1985, and then it had the exact same CPU running the exact same speed, the exact same graphics modes, the exact same external peripheral connections, except again, the monitor, but then the 800 had the monitor output. So it's like the Atari was really stagnating in terms of what they actually did with the hardware, which is pretty, if you think about what Atari did in the 70s, right? They had, you know, wave after wave of actual innovation. And then after that, just like, nope. Like, let's just redesign nope. These things and put out the same computers again and again. And it's kind of sad, but at the same time, I was glad to have it when I got the second computer. And I think for me, really, that was the thing of having two computers operating at once was really a radical shift in how I could do things. Like, just it enabled so much more productivity in game playing that I could do.
Mainly the latter.
But then it was also nice to keep the Atari 400 also for certain things, like specifically that it had the four joystick ports. So for things like four-player Mule, like you just couldn't do it otherwise. So a mixed bag, my second computer, but I was glad to have it mostly just for the sake of having two computers for a while. So
it's funny you mentioned that stagnation, because that's always what I thought of the Amiga, and it just occurred to me that it was basically the same people, right, that made the two. Because that was kind of the Amiga's problem. They crushed it out of the gate, just this like years ahead of its time, and then they did nothing for another 10 years.
Yeah, right.
Sort of begrudgingly updated the chipset, you know, several years later, but that by then it was too late. Like, they just seems to be a problem of that group somehow.
Yep. Yeah, I think because the Amiga came out in, I think, 1985, and then that's when the 1000 came out. The 500, 2000 came out shortly after with the exact same CPU, slightly bumped graphics and slightly bumped other features, but like it wasn't until like the Amiga 1200 and 3000 came out, they actually said, well, let's have a faster CPU. And I think that was 1992 or 3. So it was a thing. But I guess if, on the other hand, if you look now, if you say we're just talking about CPU speeds, if you buy a MacBook Air today, those CPU speeds nominally aren't much different than they were 4, 5, 6 years ago. They're different CPUs, and they seem to have a different sort of max, like turbo boost speed or whatever. But it's like, I don't know. But of course, other things change. But anyway, it was interesting to see how like a company can have like this spurt of incredible growth and innovation in some areas, and then just like, well, let's just coast now.
I'm done.
We did it.
Well, you see that the Atari 130XE was 0.1 millimeters thinner, you see. Oh, so
exactly. Very important.
Much like the latest iPad, yeah.
Yeah, I think the other strategy is to like change all the connectors so that you at least have to buy all the new peripherals.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what Atari should have done.
Yeah.
They failed. They kept the same connectors all the time.
Yeah, Apple figured that one out early.
Weren't forward thinking enough.
Yeah.
So let's see. So my second computer, I guess I have to decide what counts as my first one. But I think most interesting would be the Apple II Plus that my family bought, you know, basically on my strong recommendation, which I was told, this is the family's computer. This is not your computer, which in practice wound up having me use it all the time. But there were occasionally times when, you know, my siblings or parents would want to use it for something. And, you know, that was frustrating and annoying because I had to not use it for that time. So I eventually did get a computer of my own, and I think I'm going to call that one my second because it's more interesting. It also, so like all of us, this was a time of youth and not a lot of money. And so I shopped around a bit. What I ended up, I don't remember actually even how I found this. It was like an ad on a BBS, I think, somebody, because I believe that I bought this computer, which was a Apple II Plus clone. I bought it from someone in the Southeast US who shipped it to me. And, you know, somewhere I have a scan of a little piece of notebook paper that I wrote down the figures of like how much like the monitor was and how much the thing was and how much I got a 20 megabyte hard drive, which cost more than any of the other pieces, you know. And so, you know, once I got this clone, that went into my room. That was my thing. I had a nice little amber monitor for it, you know. So I've seen a number of these since. This particular one, it's in a, you know, it's in some sort of case that I think was mass produced somewhere, and a lot of clone makers used it. So it's kind of Apple II Plus shaped. It has this the cover part where you open it up to like look at the motherboard. It's strangely short. It's like this little stumpy opening. So you can kind of get at the cards, but if the cards are long, they're even hard to manipulate in there because the case goes up too far. So really, if you want to do anything on the board, you have to kind of take the whole cover off. You can kind of get at the like the joystick plug and stuff like that. But the other thing was that it when you started it up, instead of saying Apple II, it would say ready, go. Which is pretty cool. And actually, I think that was a way that some of the clone detection happened. They would look in the ROM at that point and see, does it say Apple II or not? Because if it doesn't, it's, you know, so I think I had to patch ProDOS or something like that in order to use it. But I stuck with this computer. It really was like, it was a 2 Plus, except that it had a numeric keypad, but otherwise it was basically a 2 Plus. So this, what that means is that it's uppercase only. I did have an 80 column card. It didn't have a 128K. It had just the 64K. And I resolutely stuck with that, even though there were two E's at school. And, you know, I understood that there were two E's, but no, I was happy with my 2 Plus. I did, you know, like I worked around the lack of lowercase by making, you know, my programs use inverse or whatever. So, I did stick with that all the way up until I got I went off to college and got a SE30. Like my jump was Apple II.
Oh, that's a
SE30.
Huge jump.
Wow.
So anyway, but yeah, so the case that it was made, you know, I think it just must have been like made in, you know, Taiwan or something like that and sold as pieces to people who made clones, because I've seen a lot of clones. Mine didn't even have a label. I don't know what, you know, I think it was sort of homemade, but, anyway, I've seen a couple of these actually just recently coming up in a Apple II Slack discussion that, you know, a couple of these showed up on eBay and people were saying, oh, have you seen this clone? And, you know, it really does look, it looks just like mine except under a different name. So I think probably there were just some, you know, a lot of backroom manufacturers.
Yeah, we talked about that on Open Apple once. If you ever wanted to be a person who collected Apple II clones, and I think we determined it would be virtually impossible because, like, especially coming out of South America, there were just dozens and dozens of them that all, like you said, used some common case supplier, and there's just no way to tell them apart because everything internal is off-the-shelf parts. And yeah, it's funny you mentioned the Apple II problem. There was one of the, I think it was one of the Brazilian clones that said something else in that spot. You know, it had to be the same 8 characters or whatever, so it would fit in that spot in the ROM. But it started with APP. They had some other phrase there that started with that because that was what ProDOS was checking for, was just the first 3 characters. Uh-huh. So it was something like, it said like apply on or something like that, that fit in that space, but it started with APP.
Very clever.
Yeah, that was funny.
I like how when your family wants to get a computer, you're like, you got to buy an Apple II, full real brand, do it your money. But when it's your buying computer, you're like, what's the cheapest clone I can get?
That's right. I really liked that machine. I mean, I probably liked it a lot because it was mine, you know.
Yeah.
But in large part, that is because it was mine. But yeah, I mean, I think I have a fondness for it. And I know, you know, it's sitting in my office that I can't get to, and I know right where it is. I have it still.
Did you ever find any incompatibilities with it? I always wonder that about clones.
Not really. Nothing that I was really aware of over and above, you know, just the incompatibilities with all this, you know, Apple IIe stuff. So.
Okay.
And how often would you just download, you know, highly legal software and you wouldn't know, is it just a bad crack or is it whatever? So there'd be
right.
lots
yeah.
of things to probably, I like how True. You guys all had software that was not just legal, but highly legal.
That's right.
Highly legal. Yeah. And so sometimes I would have something that wouldn't work and I would just assume, well, I guess this is just the version I have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Software just didn't work sometimes. Yeah. I guess that's still true, but yeah, right. I never found any with the laser that I know of, but yeah, again, it would be really hard to know, I guess. But I guess most of the like South American clones and stuff, they just illegally copied the ROM, I'm sure. So it was probably the real Apple ROM inside anyway.
Right. Yeah, I had a friend with some Franklin or other that occasionally would run into these compatibility problems, even ones that I didn't. It's true, though. I mean, now that I think about it, I did know people with clones.
Yeah, I could believe the Franklins had issues. I guess by the time Laser came along, the Apple II was a lot better understood, so they probably knew all of the weird hacks that they were going to have to support and so on. Like by then, I'm sure they knew that just supporting all the ROM entry points is not enough. There's a few other things that like these 20 games all do or whatever.
So the Franklin, what is it? The Franklin Ace 500. That is one of the sweet looking clones, though. The black one. I love that computer.
It's a nice looking machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm assuming that this is true on all the platforms, although I'm most familiar with it on the Apple II, but the ROM is so small and people understood it so well that, you know, just because there was a labeled entry point somewhere in the listing doesn't mean those are the only things you're going to use. I mean, like, you look at it, you know how it works. You know that if you jump in the middle of that routine, you will get a certain effect that will help you. And so it becomes impossible to, like, update the ROM at all.
And it's, by that same token, it's sort of amazing that the laser worked at all, because the code had to be different like that. Legally, it was required to be different and yet also support everything. And yet the Apple II ROM was very close to theoretically as dense as it could possibly be. I mean, literally, there were separate routines that just overlapped their code because the last half of them were close enough to being the same or whatever. So they would jump into each other and just crazy things like that. How do you support all of that behavior but have it be a different set of bytes? I think that must have been the challenge.
Like, I don't understand even now how that could have been possible.
Yeah, it's amazing. But yeah, I don't recall ever having any trouble with it. It's pretty amazing. It might be the case that software used less of the ROM than we imagined too. Like, I mean, once the machine is up, you know, you're probably writing everything in RAM yourself anyway, especially later on when there was more RAM around. I don't know. Certainly the games would have just, you know, give me track zero and then leave me alone kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, I think the Apple III, they really heavily discouraged relying on anything that's in ROM. You know, sort of, I think specifically for that reason. That they say in the little developer documentation that they never gave to anybody, they say, you know, don't rely on any of this, just use drivers for everything.
Yeah. That line doesn't work today either.
Okay. I think we made it through our second computers. So let's see, what's next? I guess there's a little bit of listener feedback. I'll mention a couple. So Ben wrote on Facebook to point out, I think we may have talked about this before, but we were talking, I guess it was 2 times ago, about old terminals. And there's a really nice program called Cool RetroTerm, which, as it turns out, also abbreviates as CRT. Which is, you know, we'll do a really nice, you know, sort of like shaky old raster monitor, rendition on your screen of your terminal prompt. So if you want to get that feeling, it defaults to a nice kind of amber, but you have a bunch of options. Have you guys used this? I think I did try a little bit to use it regularly, and then I gave up and just used my regular one.
Yeah, I've played with those a little bit.
Yeah, I've at least tried something like that, but then I haven't stuck with it ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, after the first 5 minutes, it's like, oh, neat. But then you remember, oh, CRTs were terrible. Yeah, that's right. I like having 600 columns and perfectly legible text.
Right, and sort of like arbitrarily resizable windows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And interlacing is not charming after the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, I have Apple III Plus. This is sort of only – this is not even really related. You said interlacing, and my – neurons connected in some way. But so one of the things about the Apple III Plus that differentiated it from the Apple III was that it had this extra sort of interlacing mode that would, on the original, you know, monitor, there you'd really see a line between every raster line. I mean, it was sort of like line space, line space, line space. And on the Apple III Plus, there's a switch that basically will fill them in, you know, so it sort of seems more coherent of an image. But it also flickers badly. So I'm not sure which is better. You know, I mean, like, I don't know which gives you less of a headache, but I think the flicker might actually be worse.
Yeah, I think interlacing is one of the, or scan lines is one of those things that I guess we just tuned out back then, because I had late in my laser ownership, I had a 14-inch CRT, which was pretty huge at the time, or maybe it was 15-inch. It was, mm-hmm. I mean, it was enormous. And
15 inches is in 80x inches.
Yeah. By the standards of the day, yeah. It was big enough to be like a small TV kind of. It doesn't increase your resolution or anything like it would nowadays. So now it just scales everything up. And so the 192 scan lines are now further apart. And yeah, it looked kind of terrible looking back on it, but I thought it was great.
Yeah.
You're like on a modern TV, each one of those scan lines is about an inch high. It's yeah. a bit more noticeable.
Right. Yeah. Let's see. And Bob wrote over email to point out somebody who has made a sort of like a miniature 3D printed Commodore monitor. So it's just kind of a cool little project. We've seen, I guess Charles Mangan has done some things that are sort of like this with the Apple products, and I haven't seen someone doing this with the Commodores. But this picture that I'm looking at of the 3D printed Commodore monitor, I almost cannot tell that it isn't actually, full size. I think it isn't though, right?
It's really well done.
Yeah. So this person has made a little Commodore 64, and this monitor is scaled appropriately to go with it. And so there's a Hackaday article, and there's a video that kind of goes through the process, shows the designing of the thing that is then printed. And so it's pretty cool. Anyway, I haven't looked at the video all the way through, but I think it's a neat project, and the result is astounding.
Yeah, it's scaled to match the C64 Mini, which was one of those, like, here's a bunch of games in a plastic thing that you plug into your TV. It's one of those. Yeah, the keyboard on it isn't real, but it does actually plug into your TV and play Commodore 64 games. There's, 50 games on it or something.
All right.
So they've scaled it to that. And I think this must be like SLS printed or something, or else they did a whole lot of sanding. But just the scale of the details suggests, I think that's got to be, that can't be like your traditional drizzled plastic 3D printing.
Okay.
FDM, as they say.
Yeah, it looks very, very smooth.
Yeah, it's very nice.
Yeah, I didn't quite parse that properly originally, that this was scaled to match a product that was separately available.
Mm.
But okay, that's cool. So it's sort of like the Atari flashback things or whatever, except the Commodore version.
Yeah,
exactly. And in fact, there's a new version of it that recently came out that's actually full size and has a working keyboard. It's very unfortunately named the C64. Like, that's the product name.
Oh,
the word
right.
The. So totally yeah. Ungoogleable. But it is right. Apparently good. I think they just released the NTSC version. Rob O'Hare has been talking about it a lot since he's my source of Commodore information.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I noticed that some things were appearing on that feed again. So it's easy. Yeah. I'm so behind. I need to commute. If I don't commute, I can't hear any podcasts.
I have the same problem. I've had to train myself to listen to podcasts in all other contexts because, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. In March, I had like 200 unlistened podcasts instantly. I didn't realize how well-tuned my feed was to the length of my commute.
Right.
But yeah, Rob has restarted all of his podcasts pretty much, which is awesome because he's one of my favorite podcasters. He's just so good at it.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I will try to bubble those up to the top of my feed. But actually, I have this terrible habit, which and that would this habit that I'm about to relate would mean that if I were a listener to this podcast, I would never hear it. But I tend to, if there's a short, like 15-minute one, that one goes to the top of the queue. Because then I can sort of get through something and check a box. And the long ones get saved for later. And that list, it's hundreds of hours now.
Yeah.
So
I have a couple of those that I had to drop. I listened to a history podcast that's an hour a week, and I just had to unsubscribe because they were just piling up at the bottom of the queue. I was never going to get to them. So
I haven't quite given up on these, but it's hard to imagine that I would ever actually get through them all.
It's like my Steam game queue. Sure, I'll play those games eventually. Just keep buying them.
Yeah,
one of these days.
Okay, so let's see. Rob wrote to talk a little bit about the recent discussions of 3270 terminals and the development system. There was a 50s blue development system for the 8088 or something like that. Anyway, so Rob said that around 1983, I worked for a Minnesota company, Lee Data, that made 3270 compatible terminals, and they were sort of like knockoffs, I guess. We undercut IBM's prices because instead of the controllers and terminals being custom hardware, they made stuff that was based on 8086 and 8088 chips. But anyway, they built these things based on kind of like off-the-shelf 8086 chips. And Rob was trying to explain like how these pieces fit together, and I only kind of barely understood it. However, Quinn also tried to explain this in an email. Yes. And so maybe Quinn has a better grasp of this, but it basically had to do with how the computer connected to the protocol converter, connected to the cluster controller, connected to the mainframe.
Right. Yeah, I'm less familiar with the 3270, but when we get to the news items, I do want to talk about the 2260.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, and I have this project, which I think I've mentioned the last couple of times, that I would someday like to make happen, which involves getting from an Apple III 3270 terminal program to a Raspberry Pi simulating a mainframe. But not sure if that's going to happen. I think what that means is maybe we're done with the listener feedback for now.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Okay.
We're done with you, listeners.
There was a bunch from me, but then I just came on the show. I'm like, this is just more efficient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Easier.
Right.
The last shows, I've been like, ooh, I have opinions on that.
Right.
There's so many corrections. She's like, I can't type this, Matt. I just have to come on the show and tell you guys why you're wrong.
That's right.
That's how I got started on this.
Yeah, that's true.
So they suck you in on this show.
Okay. So now I guess we can turn to the items of interest and news. Carrington being alphabetically first.
Woo!
Present.
I'll take it. It's a win. I've got an item from Hackaday, because yay for Hackaday. If you live in Poland and you want to make your vintage computers be the color that they were originally, and this whole retrobrighting stuff is just too much work for you, then you can now buy some spray paint cans with vintage computer colors. So there is, at the moment, Atari Gray, Commodore Beige, and Amiga Beige. So you've got a C64. You want to make it back to the original color? You can spray paint it, but only if you live in Poland, because that's the only place these things are available. I think this is awesome, and I think news shouldn't just be about what's available locally. So hooray for spray paint cans of non-Apple computers. Like, this is all way out of my wheelhouse, is what I'm saying. It's great. There's in the Hackaday article, it's got links to also a how-to guide on how to spray paint a vintage computer, how to take it apart, how to mask it, how to get the best results if you're going to spray paint an old computer. I don't actually recommend any of this, but because I think if you're going to paint your computer, then go like fluorescent pink, make it fuchsia or some other color I can't spell. Like, just go crazy, right? Why just make it the same color again? Whatever. But, you know, whatever floats your boat. So vintage computer plus Polish plus no changing colors from the sun. If that's who you are, then I have the link for you. Hackaday says paint your computers. Cool. Are you guys going to run out and get this? Going to go to Poland, get some spray paint cans? Do it, Paul.
I mean, I'm pretty close. I'm not that far from Poland.
Yeah, come on, Jack. Do it. Go. Spray paint some Atari stuff.
I think the fact that they're in Poland is the only reason they can get away with actually using all the company logos on these products.
Exactly.
Yeah. People do still own those trademarks. They'd be getting some C&Ds if they were in the U.S.
Yeah, they could have a licensing deal. You don't know.
I think someone in the comments on this article actually also points out that the Pantone colors for all of these are known. And so if you can't buy these, you can actually go to a custom paint store and just give them the color code and they can mix it up for you as well. So
nice. Mm-hmm. Always read the comments.
That's right.
Twist, never read the comments. Well, actually, maybe on Hackaday.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't make any enemies, but.
Yeah, I think the Apple ones, I've seen very rarely touch-up kits for like the Apple II Plus and stuff like that. Because at least there's a small set of the Apple II series that were painted. And so there's paint, and you can get touch-up paint for it. I mean, obviously, there was a particular one that was black, and that was clearly painted. But even the Apple II Pluses were generally painted, and there's a small set of 2Es that were. So I think Tony Diaz has brought some of the touch-up paint occasionally to Kansas Fest meetings, and I've seen some, you know, actually on eBay occasionally. But and I wonder if that's even a good idea, you know, because I'm not sure if the paint itself is still, you know, liquid. But
yeah, I doubt the paint is any good after 40 years or whatever.
Yeah.
Chris Torrance has done a bunch of investigation to find modern spray paint colors that are close, and I don't remember which ones he found, but he identified a couple because he took his Night Owl monitors apart to paint them to match the Apple II, and he found some really good matches. I saw them at K-Fest a couple years ago, and I was really impressed with how well it matched, so we'll have to get Chris to write in with the names of the colors that he uses.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I think I remember once seeing what the Pantone colors were supposed to be, and finding, like, it's interesting how they just don't look like the same color at all on the screen. I mean, like, once it gets applied to an object, then it winds up being the same after all. But
yeah.
I would not, if I tried to match it by eye, I would get totally the wrong color.
Yeah, and you really have to paint the same type of plastic and then let it dry before you know. Like, you can't match, if you go to Home Depot with the lid off your Apple II, you'll never get it. Like, you have to actually paint a bunch of stuff.
Unless you want to paint your house that color, I suppose. That would be, see, that's like Carrington's bag, right? Like, you know, somebody drives by the house, if they recognize that as the Apple II Plus color,
then I want to be their friend.
You want to, yeah.
Exactly.
I love it.
So I'm going to make all my friends now. What color is my house? And why is it slowly turning more yellow? Yeah. Our friendship will be completely based on your answer.
Why are you covering your house with a peroxide paste exactly?
Okay, let's see. The next one I have here is basically stolen from feedback. So part of why we didn't have feedback is because I stole stuff from it. But this is, Norman on Facebook pointed out that there is this GoTek alternative that is being sold. It's the OpenFlops USB floppy disk drive emulator. And it's, so I'm only like half aware of how the, you know, all this GoTek stuff, but there's a kind of a standard floppy drive emulator in hardware that you can use to like plug into your various old machines with a floppy drive connector called the GoTek. And there is a project, which I think it's this flash floppy project that basically just will, you know, it's sort of like different firmwares that will work for your different machines. So I have a couple of these GoTek devices, and one of them I have plugged into an Amiga 500. And I think, as I recall, I had to do some fancy thing to flash the firmware on it so that it would act like an Amiga drive. But then after that, it worked fine. And this is basically another alternative, and reportedly a fairly cheap one that has the flash floppy firmware all kind of built in. Like, it's sort of better designed for the uses we want to put it to rather than the GoTek, which is kind of more designed for people who want to, you know, keep their, you know, whatever they are, synthesizers or sewing machines running or whatever it is that they were for. Anyway, that's about as far as I got in this. But it does look interesting. It looks very targeted at specifically our sector. And it's open hardware. It supports the Center for Computing History. For every OpenFlops drive sold, 50p is donated. Mm-hmm. There's a Discord server with 7 people online.
Cool.
Somebody had said, oh, it's only $33. And that does, in fact, seem about right. It is basically 20 British pounds.
Hmm.
So that's like nothing.
Yeah, that seems really cheap.
That is very cheap.
Yeah. These are basically things that you plug into pretty standard floppy controllers and things that are more recent than stuff like, you know, the Atari 800 and the Apple II.
Right.
But good for Amigas and PCs and stuff like that.
We have a comment in the live comments on YouTube. Brian B. says, GoTek is as cheap, But this allows support of 2 drives.
Okay. Excellent. So, yeah, I'm definitely pondering this. I have, I don't know, 2 or 3 GoTek drives. One of them I put in the Amiga, and the others I sort of filed for later and then, you know, piled other things on top of them, and probably will take me 4 years before I see them again. So, in the meantime, maybe I'll get one of these.
Cool.
Anyway, it seems like a neat thing. And I like that it's so cheap that it's, you know, it's sort of like a low risk to just try it out, see if it does what you want. If it doesn't, you know, 20 pounds.
And I want to say that the owner of this website gets huge bonus points for making your mouse pointer into an Amiga mouse pointer when you're mousing around the website.
Yeah.
Oh, is that what that's doing? Oh. That's such a good idea.
It's brilliant.
That's the best use of CSS I've ever seen.
Yeah. Right.
Totally.
Finally,
it paid for itself.
CSS can be used for good, finally.
Exactly.
So that is an Amiga cursor? I didn't know. That's cool.
Yep.
Yeah. It's something, though, for sure.
I mean, to me, it looks like the Amiga pointer. Yeah. I haven't actually used Amiga in many, many years, but that's what it reminds me of.
I always find it so disorienting when you have a cursor that like points the other way or at a slightly different angle or whatever. It's just like
right.
Other people's mouse pointers are always terrible.
Yep.
Like I think actually the Amiga pointer actually did go the other way. Instead of pointing up to the left, it pointed up to the right. So I think they've like flipped it so that it works within the confines of what a pointer is supposed to be today. But yeah. I may be wrong on that too.
Okay.
I always hated the 2GS Finder in 640 mode because the resolution doubled, and so then the mouse pointer just got skinnier, and it distorted it just enough that it drove me crazy. Like, it looked weird to me.
All right. And Quinn, you have the next thing without a link, but some numbers and letters.
Quinn is the link.
And some twos.
Yes, there's twos in it. There you go. That's definitely why I chose this item, and not because I got all excited when you guys were talking about terminals a couple episodes ago. Which is not a sentence I ever thought I would say in my life, but here we are. So my news item is I want to talk about the IBM 2260 because I want to talk about the IBM 2260. So a couple episodes ago, you guys were talking about different terminals, and it was kind of kismet because about a year ago, I just learned about this thing, and it was so much more interesting than I expected because, you know, I used VT100s back in school, and I sort of assumed it's one of those things where you look at the later version of a technology, and it's such a logical way to do it that you assume that's just how it's always been done, right? A VT100 terminal has a character generator in it, and it takes serial data from the mainframe, and it has a keyboard, sends serial data back. Perfectly logical way to do it. That must be how they always did it. That is definitely not how they always did it. And so the IBM 2260 was the terminal system that was, I believe, was contemporary with the IBM 360 mainframes. And you see a picture of it, and it looks like a terminal, but I read a little piece of how it works, and I was like, what? No, that can't be how that works. And then I started reading up on it, and the more I read about this thing, the weirder it got. So you guys were talking about cluster controllers in that episode, and the 2260 does have a cluster controller. So you'd have a room with, say, 20 of these things in it, these terminals, and then there would be a cluster controller in the corner of the room that connected to the mainframe. And in later terminals, like the 3270, the cluster controller is what you're imagining. It would be like a mini computer that was just brokering serial data back and forth to all the terminals in that room and just serving to take some of the load off of the mainframe. The IBM 2260 did not work that way. The terminals, you know, we talk about thin clients. This is a thin client. These terminals are literally a cathode ray tube and a keyboard. There is no signal processing. There is no rendering. These things can't even rasterize their own characters. That's how thin these clients are. So the cluster controller in this case, and it caught my attention because Blake mentioned the gas plasma terminals that he was describing that had a really thick cable that ran to them. And that's probably it was this 2260 style where there's a cable the thickness of a baby's arm running to every single one. It's a technical terminal, technical cable dimension. And this cable, so what the cluster controller isn't sending data to the terminals, it's actually rasterizing everybody's screens. So it's actually doing the scan conversion and displaying the characters. So it's literally sending the electron gun waveforms to every single terminal. And and it can support something like, I think it's 20 or 24 terminals at a time, which sounds like madness that it could rasterize that many screens at a time. And so they got around that with a lot of optimizations. So one of the things that it does is it uses a slow phosphor screen so that it can interlace the terminals really heavily. So it'll rasterize a couple of lines on one and then move to the next one. And it'll kind of round robin its way around the room. And the phosphors were slow enough that it could manage to refresh everybody's screens. And then part of that, I forget the exact details here, but part of that was also that the screens were rasterized vertically, not horizontally. And you might think, oh, it's like an arcade monitor where it's just sitting in portrait. And so it's actually horizontal. No, this is actually a portrait monitor with vertical scan lines. And I have to go and find the book again where I read about this, but the vertical scan lines was to do with being able to rasterize 20 screens at a time. So that's why it was some property that they gained by doing that. So that was, yeah, again, you read a little piece of this thing and you're like, what? No, that can't be how it worked. That's how it worked. And then the cluster controller itself also, I mean, this was all about saving chips, right? And so that's why it's designed so weirdly. And so in the cluster controller itself, even they were trying to optimize chip count as well. So it has acoustic delay line memory. So not only is it rasterizing 20 screens, but it's storing the frame buffers of all of those 20 screens in acoustic delay line memory. So this particular one used what they call magnetostrictive delay lines. And that was, you may have seen these if you've ever been to the Computer History Museum. It was the technology that came right after mercury delay lines. So a mercury delay line where you have a big tube full of mercury and you send a piezoelectric pulse, a shockwave in one end of it, and it takes, you know, 5 milliseconds to get to the other end, and congratulations, you just stored a bit for 5 milliseconds. So the UNIVAC used that for its main system memory, and I think so it had like a 55-gallon drum of these magnetic delay lines, and I think it got 256 words of 35 bits plus checksum bits, so it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 8K out of like a 55-gallon drum. The cool thing about delay line memory is that they rate it in bits per square foot. It was the amount of memory that you could store in a physical area because it was just so physically large. So magnetostrictive delay lines could get down to 1K per square foot, which was actually quite good. So they were similar in principle, but they take advantage of the fact that there are certain metals that change shape in a magnetic field. And one of those metals is nickel. So it takes advantage of a torsion effect in a wire. So what happens is you've got a piece of nickel sitting inside a magnetic field, an electromagnet, and the electromagnet is pulsing with the data. And each time that happens, that little piece of nickel changes shape a little bit. It twists. And then you attach a long wire to that piece of nickel, and it sends a twisting force down the length of that wire. And then you can read it at the other end. And the cool thing about using the torsion effect rather than a compressive shockwave like the mercury used is that it's not sensitive to the physical structure of the delay line. So it means you can coil up that wire. So that's how they got so much, in quotes, density of data. They managed to get a K per square foot because you could coil up the wire with the little piece of nickel at one end. So that's the memory technology that was used in the cluster controller for the 2260. Now, the hilarious part of all that is because it was because it's a torsion, it's a physical effect that's running through the wire. And so what that means is it's sensitive to other physical effects in the environment. For example, stomping around in heavy boots. So if you stomped around in heavy boots near the cluster controller of a 2260 terminal room, you could actually cause garbage to appear on everybody's screens. And so because you could actually disrupt the bits in memory that were being sent to the CRTs. And similarly, there was restrictions on how they were installed. You couldn't install your cluster controller, for example, too close to an elevator because the constant vibration of the elevator would disrupt the memory in the cluster controller. So it's one of those – it's the whole system is just all dead-end technologies, like one after another. And I love dead-end technologies. This whole thing is the laser disc or the tape loop of terminal systems. And I don't know, I guess it was the best way to do it at the time, but everything about it is just blows my mind that that's really how they did it. And so I love this thing and got all excited, had to talk about it.
Cool.
Wow.
I love the idea of memory storage you can see. Look at it and go like, here's my bit.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild. Yeah, I'm sure that the things that we were talking about as cluster controllers were they relied a lot more on the terminals on the other end doing something.
Yeah, the later systems like the 3270, they were what we would think of now as terminals. Yeah, where you're sending serial data back and forth, and it's not too difficult to make something like an Apple III serve that role. It's just literally taking a little bit of processing load off the mainframe, and the terminals themselves have the Motorola whatever 6845 or whatever it is, the character controller or character rendering chip in them, and so they can do their own displays and handle their own refresh and so on. So yeah. And those would have been all connected with something like ThinNet or, like 10Base2 or something like that. Mm. Yeah. But yeah, if you have a terminal with a baby's arm cable, then it's going to be this other style. And what's kind of a bummer about this is it would be so cool to see something like this running, but it's one of these technologies that you probably can't ever, as a collector, have because the infrastructure required. You'd have to devote a room in your house to an IBM 2260 display, if you would, because you'd have to have the terminals and this cluster controller and then a mainframe on top of that to talk to it. And some of those pieces you could fake with like a Raspberry Pi, but the cluster controller and the terminal, you really have to have both because they're two, you know, halves of the same brain effectively.
Mm-hmm. Very weird.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, it does sort of seem like when you were describing this, it seemed a little bit like it's as if it was just they took one big display and then cut it up into like 16 different pieces and spread it around the room. You know, I mean, like that's sort of what it's doing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, and it's not totally clear from what I've read exactly why they did it that way. Perhaps because it was just so early and that was what they were able to do with the technology that they had. It might have been, you know, maybe even a year later, maybe there were cheap character rendering chips or something, but maybe at the time there wasn't. I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, this was just looking at my data here. This is 1964. So, yeah, this is very early. So, yeah, I'm sure that was the best they could do at the time.
I sort of feel like I came across some of these pictures, like this. There's one picture of like, you know, black and white picture of somebody with their rotary phone, you know, typing on one of these things. But I feel like I saw this photo when we were talking about the origin of 80x24. Mm. I didn't actually scroll through this to see, but that was another thing that was not like it wasn't necessarily dictated by anything. It was just IBM chose to do that and everybody followed. and I think the difference between 24 and 25 had to do with like whether they had a status line on the bottom or not.
Yeah, and I think it came from like they had enough memory for 960 characters per display, and then that whatever 80 or 40x24 was sort of a decent aspect ratio that fit on the tube on the CRT. I think that's kind of how they landed on that probably, because I think, yeah, the number of characters works out to a convenient number of bits.
Yeah.
In EBCDIC or whatever they used.
EBCDIC. I've never had to interact with EBCDIC at all, but I grew up in a house with a systems programmer. So I would hear a systems programmer who would just throw acronyms around with like reckless abandon, knowing that no one else would understand. They're, you know, so I knew how to pronounce DASDI and EBCDIC and stuff just because for no good reason I would hear them around the house. But anyway. Okay, let's see. I guess, Carrington, you have the next thing.
I do? What have I got?
You have 8086.
Oh, this is cool. Okay,
more.
Yes.
8086 or 8086 microcode.
Exactly. So the 8086, probably most people listening know that it's a chip, but some people might not know that unlike things like, say, the 6502, it had microcode. And the microcode for the chip has been disassembled. Now, throwing up on screen at the moment for people listening is a photograph of the chip. See, what happened was Ken Sheriff, who we've talked about many times in earlier episodes, does very, very cool things. And one of the things he did was he grabbed an 8086 and he took off the metal layer and the polysilicon layer. And so you've got just like the underlying silicone and all the 30,000 or so transistors. He took a super high resolution photo of it. So that's kind of cool. And so it's basically a giant photograph of thousands of transistors. So that's what we're looking at right now. Top left corner, this would be the, what is that? That's the, I don't know what that part would be. That's the adder, I think. Okay. These are registers, but bottom left corner here, we have a little football field with tons of transistors. And that's the microcode. So microcode, if you think about it, like people, when I was a kid, people talk about, I'm gonna write stuff in like assembler. I'm going to do it in machine code. That's the lowest level. I'm at the bare metal. No, dude. Is lower than low, and that's the microcode. So the microcode is the stuff in the chip that's like the actual instructions doing things, and it's specific to this chip. But it's done in transistors. Basically, if there's a transistor there, it's a one. If there's a lack of transistor, it's a zero. That's code you can see. Just like Quinn was just talking about, like look at this. There's ways to store things that you can look at. Well, since this is a high-resolution photograph, then a person who runs a blog, it took me an embarrassing amount of time. Is the reverse engineering blog, so it's just the word engineer spelled backwards, and it's sad that didn't occur. I'm like, who is this person's name? Rienigni? No, it's reverse engineer.
I assumed it was French or something.
Yeah, exactly. So sadly, reverse engineer. Reverse engineer blog said, well, I can decode that. I'm just going to look at it, and has decoded the microcode for the 886 based on this photograph, which is such a cool thing to do. So a person has come up with the actual decode and then compared the code in the actual chip with the listings that were submitted for copyright. So you can and see, well, here's how it was different, but kind of, in a sense, more interesting, since when you make this, you can make mistakes, you got to work around things, and there's some time limits. So there's junk code, there's stuff there that you can see, well, they wrote this and then leap over there. Here's a mistake, a part that's not used anymore. Here's a part that's simply, as far as we can tell, not used, so it must have been an earlier idea. So you get a whole bunch of stuff from looking at this, because you get to see the flaws and the kind of the human element to it. It's kind of neat. And so they were looking for Easter eggs, looking for stuff in the instructions, all based on Ken Sheriff took a photograph, super high resolution, of a bunch of transistors. I think that is totally awesome. And I thought we'd share both a link to the blog, and I'll put in some links to the photographs themselves from Ken Sheriff's blogs, his blog as well. So you guys heard about this? Quinn probably did this already before everybody else.
I have been reading Ken's blog on this. He's been doing a top-to-bottom reverse engineer of the 8086, and it is fantastic. He did a whole blog post just on the power distribution, which is one of those things that sounds like it would be boring, but it's so, so clever what they did, because they only had one metal layer and one semiconductor layer. So power, like modern chips are like 78 layers or something, but they only had one metal layer where all your power has to go. So, yeah, Ken goes into great detail about how all the clever things that he had to route power. Yeah, it's really, really cool. And clock distribution is another big one. This was, I guess, the last chip that does not use phase-locked loop clocks internally, which is a more sophisticated way to distribute and manage clocks. So this is old school, where it's just literally there's one clock pulse running through the entire chip, which is right on the edge of being impossible because of how big and complex the layout is. So he talks, he did a whole article just on how the clock is distributed internally in the chip. And again, it's amazing. They were just right at the limit of what they could do with this level of technology that they had.
I aspire to read Ken Sheriff's blogs. I mean, I've loved every one that I have made it through, and I see that there's, you know, an order of magnitude more of them that I have not read. And I understand about, you know, 60% of what each one has, but they're super interesting, and I learn stuff from every one.
Yeah, there's definitely some of them where I get a quarter of the way in and I'm just like, I'm lost. Like, I need to go watch people get hit by trucks on YouTube or something. My brain is done.
Yes. The standard activity of the retro computing enthusiast after their brain is done. Okay, let's see. I think that might actually be it for news items that we had, but that's all right. We can wander off on any topic.
Sorry, one more thing actually related to this. Something else that is really cool that's similar is the reverse engineering of arcade ROMs. I wish I could come up with an example off the top of my head, but there have been a couple where dumping the ROM the traditional way, just like, you know, putting power to it and reading the data out of the chip, there have been ROMs where that hasn't been possible. Like there's a couple of really rare arcade games, I think, where the chip was destroyed and it's like the only physical, you know, known copy or whatever. So they have they've reverse engineered or they've extracted the code out of the ROM by decapping the chip and, again, literally taking high resolution photos of the die, and you can, you know, it's a diode matrix, and depending on where all the little wires cross in the matrix, you can tell what the actual data is. And so you can, again, you can literally read the data by looking at a photograph of the connections inside the ROM. And some of the games that are on MAME have been emulated by getting the code out of the ROM chips that way.
That is pretty astounding. Yeah, I know that there was arcade games that protected themselves by, like, if the power went out or, you know, that there's, like, a little vat of acid or something like that, that it would like, destroy the chip if you tried to move it out.
Yeah, there's the suicide boards, they call them, or they have a couple of different names, but there's two versions of them. There's ones that were intentionally suicide, and there was others that were accidental suicide. So there's a particular maybe someone else knows more, but there was a particular, I think, Sega board where they mounted the battery at the top of the board, and so it would leak and run down the board and just wipe everything out on the way down. And then there was another line of boards, I think from, I want to say Namco, later like fighting game boards, I think, where, yeah, it literally had a crypto key stored in SRAM with a battery backup. And if the SRAM, if the battery died on that, then it was lost forever. And that was it. You were toast. Mm-hmm. And contemporarily, they had a hotline that you could call and give them your, serial number and your receipt that or whatever that you own this arcade machine. And they had some system where they could send out a tech or whatever and get your machine running again. But of course, nowadays that 1-800 number doesn't work anymore. So you're just toast if you get one of these boards with a dead battery.
It was the CP system. Is the from Capcom, like the Street Fighter stuff.
Capcom,
like
that's right.
That had the A, was the A board and the B board, and one of those two had the battery-backed decryption key. And now it's dead. Too bad. Board is committed suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those, I assume, like no matter however much sort of decapping of chips you do, will probably not help that unless you... Although now we have the computing power to just run through all the keys, I suppose.
Yeah, those boards have been cracked, I believe. But in any case, I mean, we have all the code for all of them anyway. But if you have a specific board, I believe there is a crack you can do to get access to it if you want to get your physical game running again. But I think it's easier nowadays just to flash cracked ROMs onto chips and put them on your board.
Or just, hook up a Raspberry Pi and emulator and be done with it.
Not the same.
I guess not. I do sometimes wonder about that. That if what you have a joystick and you have a screen in front of you, it's a CRT. Can you the Pepsi Challenge or whatever? Can you tell whether it was actually running on the chip or on a
Raspberry Pi? That's a good question. Yeah.
I think depending on the game and depending on the player's skill. If someone is, someone has made themselves a real expert at playing Pac-Man Arcade, right? And they know, they have the exact timing down when things happen. Like, probably any emulation, they will notice it's going to be slower. There's going to be a delay because, that joystick was directly hardwired to something that that could be, read in no time, zero time, in the time of, the minimum step that a processor could do. Like, you could read if a joystick went on or off. So it's like there were no layers between, there were no protocols between, there was no nothing.
Yeah, I think input delay might be the giveaway on any of these, because, they're virtually zero input delay and output delay, especially any modern system. Like, you've got HDMI conversion and you've got LCD rasterizing and you've got various layers of video transcoding and, each of these layers is accumulating a millisecond or two of delay, whereas the original hardware had, video memory that was being scanned directly by a CRT, and there's just zero delay there. And so that and that's one of the problems with emulation, is that, those input delays can definitely make the game feel different. It might still be playable and fun, but it does feel slightly different.
Or if you're Billy Mitchell, maybe you hope nobody notices this.
I was just about to bust out Billy Mitchell. Yeah, that's how they caught him, is that they could tell in the video footage, the hardcore people could tell that it was emulated just because the timing was slightly different. Yeah, pretty amazing. For anyone who doesn't know, Billy Mitchell's most recent high score was disqualified because, they analyzed his video and determined that he was cheating playing on an emulator.
Then I think they went and put it back. I don't know. I think maybe it got reinstated or he was suing people. I don't know what's up with that. But
yeah, it's messy.
Kind of the most famous current one, though, of this whole, hey, you're cheating. I can tell from looking at that is not an actual arcade machine. So.
Yeah. Okay. This is the point where we usually have the upcoming show roundup. And I haven't actually done a very good check of what is coming up. Mostly, it's still a list of things that say, and the thing I'm looking at, it still says, postponed, canceled, whatever. So the only thing I was going to mention is that, which maybe I'll even call a feedback, is that there's been a new WASFest announced. So WASFest 17 is on October 17th, and it will be streamed over Twitch. It is, it's in Australia. It's in Sydney, I think. And noon in Sydney. For a small number of people can actually be there and streamed on Twitch otherwise. And so given that we have a heavily Apple-themed crew here anyway, I'll at least put that in there. because it was sent as feedback. But so, and with that, I guess we can go to a word from our sponsor.
Ladies and gentlemen, IBM presents the 3279 color terminal. Mr. Reuben Singer is at the keyboard. Observe how the color terminal saves your eyes a lot of work. First, a simple listing of sales districts. Districts that have met their quota in yellow. Three districts fell below quota. And one 20% over. The same information on a bar graph. Sales trends by product on a pie chart, brimming with color. A quick look at how our theoretical company is doing countrywide. The IBM Color Terminal and Friends. IBM, helping put information to work for people.
So the retro computing gift idea this time is the Mule board game, which reminded many of us of the Lode Runner board game. Oh, Quinn, you played the Lode Runner board game, right? I think
I did. Yeah, that was one of the moments recently where I was like, "Ooh, I wish I was on the show because I have opinions."
Yeah, I played it at the Cancer Fest.
Yeah, so yeah, it was me and Carrington and a couple other people. I'm sorry whose names I've forgotten, but your analysis was correct. It was really terrible, but there was one very clever aspect to it, which Carrington, maybe you remember. There was something about like the barrels could sit, like they slotted into your little dude or something. There was something really clever about the physical design of the pieces.
I don't even remember that. I just remember the impression that this is not a good game.
Yeah, I think it was that you could carry a barrel around and that, like, the barrel fit into a recess on your player's piece or something. There was something like that where it was like, okay, that's neat, but the rest of the game was awful. Yeah, we really okay. Tried to like it, but no, it's not good.
So yeah. I just searched. I did a quick Google search for Lode Runner board game, and like, the third image that comes up is a photograph of us playing the game, and Michael Mulhern is also at the table. So it turns out all the hosts that played this game were not there when you guys discussed it last time.
That's perfect. Sorry, Michael. I'm sorry. I forgot you.
But it's hilarious that there's so many of us on this show that were playing that particular game. None of them on the episode that you guys were talking about.
I love that we're now the top hit on that board game. We're the only people who've ever played it, apparently.
That's great.
Well, and actually timely, since we talked about Rob O'Hara and Lode Runner, Rob O'Hara's podcast Sprite Castle, which I love, and I don't care the least bit about Commodore 64 games, but I once spent an hour listening to Rob O'Hara talk about a ditch behind his house, so apparently there's no bar. Right. But he talked about Lode Runner on the Commodore 64, and I was definitely having a lot of I have opinions on this for that as well, because of course the Apple II was the OG platform for that game. But one of the things that was he mentioned in that was that for some reason they changed all of the colors in the Commodore 64 version. So of course the Apple II version was all blue and white and orange because that's all they had. In the Commodore version, they made everything red, green, and brown for no reason, because the Commodore has all those colors that were in the original. And they didn't make it look better. They just made it three different terrible colors. Like, the Commodore version could have been 16 colors and looked nice, but they just made it look terrible differently. And then for some reason, the title screen, however, was the Apple II colors. So the title screen was the same blue and orange and white as the Apple II title screen. And so that was also a mystery. So something, it must have been a hasty port or something. They did some kind of straight over conversion of all the graphics. But I just thought that was all interesting. I didn't know any of that about the Commodore version.
It is possible. There's an Atari. Oh, I guess this was the Commodore you were saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you were saying that, I was thinking Atari, because there's with Atari, I think there is a graphics mode that you can do a fairly quick conversion with.
Right.
Because I was thinking, now I'm pausing and not quite sure whether I'm thinking Commodore or Atari, but Apple Panic got converted, and I think maybe that was to Commodore, and so Apple Panic is kind of like Lode Runner in a way. It's a sort of like climbing platform, you know, ladders game. But one thing that I remember noticing that I thought was very weird was that, so Apple Panic is a fairly early Apple game. When you see like the little characters moving around on the screen, they use the two different palettes. And so occasionally, like if you have a character using one palette that runs next to a ladder that is written drawn in the other palette, then the ladder just changes color, you know. And I thought that was very weird that this was recreated so faithfully on the port, you know, like the ladder would change color as well. And I was wondering if that was also due to a palette limitation, or whether that was really actually just a thing. But I think it was probably, I don't know, Jack, do you know Apple Panic? Is that an Atari game also?
I don't know that. But just hearing what you're saying, I wonder if it could be that they were using an XOR mechanism to draw and undraw the play field. Because that can be a thing where you see a character moving in front of something, and then, oh, it moves in front of a thing, and now everything is a weird color, and then it moves away, and then it's back. And I've seen a number of, like, quickly done games that do that kind of thing. So if you don't have sprites, XORing with the background is a pretty effective way of being able to not have to redraw the background later, because you just un-XOR it again on the player.
Right. I think that's not what's happening here.
Okay.
I'll see if I can maybe find a little YouTube video to point to at some point. But because I remember thinking, because I knew that was kind of like I think of it as kind of like a defect in Apple Panic. You know, it seems kind of like an error of a kind, but to see that it showed up on a different platform just kind of blew my mind.
Maybe the porter thought it was a gameplay mechanic of some sort that they didn't understand, so they better keep it.
Better leave it in.
Yeah, maybe that's part of its popularity.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
This seems to be part of the product specification, which is the existing game.
Yeah.
Well, something else that jumped out about Commodore Lode Runner that didn't occur to me is that, oh, hey, there we are playing. sorry, on the YouTube stream, we have a picture of two of the four people on the show playing the Lode Runner board game.
Yeah.
What jumped out at me about the Commodore Lode Runner was that it does not have two joystick buttons, right? And the Apple II does. So on the Apple II, the two buttons were for digging to your left and to your right. Commodore doesn't have that, so it just sounded like unplayably different to me. So it only digs in front of you. You can't dig behind you. And then there's a key on the keyboard that switches that so that you can only dig behind you. So you're running around with one hand on the keyboard switching your default dig direction, or else you have to quickly turn around and dig the other way.
Yeah, I played it on the Atari extensively, and I don't remember if there was a key to switch behavior. I didn't know it. I just always dug in front of me. So yeah, you would run, and then like quickly turn and dig and turn back and keep running. But it was quite responsive, so you didn't have to there was not a long wait if you had to like turn and dig and turn back. You could like be in a blink of an eye, like it was. So it worked. It wasn't as nice as the Apple II though, with the two buttons.
Yeah, I suppose if you adjusted the animation timing, you could get it to feel the same. But yeah, it definitely sounded clunkier than.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it's definitely clunkier.
I found a version of this. So this is for the VIC-20.
Pack. I just saw the ladder change.
Yeah, and so what's the deal with that?
So I think that is the limited palette. So the VIC-20 and the Commodore 64, they have where the screen is chunked into like chunks of a certain number of pixels, if it's 8x8 or whatever. And then within that chunk, you can only have a certain number of colors.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's exactly the same problem, basically, that the Apple had.
So it's a different problem that happens to create the same artifact. So the sprites are only two colors. So you get black and one color. So the ones and zeros, you set the color of each sprite or each screen region, like Jack was saying. So yes, when the player enters that region, the ones all become the player's color, and that's why the ladders change color. As opposed to the Apple II, where you're flipping the palette bit in the screen memory, but it's sort of similar problem, but not exactly. It's in the sprite hardware instead of being in the frame buffer. But yeah, it's interesting how they both create the same artifact.
I looked up we were talking about the Commodore 64 version of Lode Runner having a weird red look to it. So I wanted to see, well, what would the ZX Spectrum color look like? Is it like all just in pink and neon cyan? But turns out it's all in red. It looks remarkably similar. So I wonder if the Spectrum one came first and maybe Commodore is actually a port of the Spectrum version? Because it's remarkably muted on Spectrum compared to most Spectrum ones, which are just like, take these colors into your eyes. I dare you.
Yeah, I was just going to talk about that. The spectrum, talking about, again, that color blocking problem, the spectrum was crazy extreme that way, right? Like you got four different regions or something for the entire screen. So like your character was yellow on the entire left half of the screen or whatever. And it was just, the games all look super bizarre because of that. But I guess the players were just used to it.
Spectrum games always look like they're using those old arcade color overlays.
Yeah, an overlay.
Like totally. Somebody just put cellophane over it, and but it goes here, now it's yellow.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, the lower left corner of the entire screen is just yellow, and everyone's just okay with that. I'm like, how do you play on that?
It took so long to load from that cassette that you're just going to accept anything on the screen now.
Yeah. So we're all of the ZX people are flipping their tables right now. So yeah, we're confusing the Spectrum with the earlier, like the ZX81 or what was it?
Oh yes, the I love them all together.
Yeah, yeah. The earlier one had the crazy massive blocked colors.
It's all the ones that start with Z.
Yeah, Spectrum had much, much better graphics. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so that concludes our discussion of the retro competing gift idea, the mule board game. We never did actually say what that was. So let me maybe go back to the mule board game. Then a little harp music as we go back in time.
Good luck editing that.
But the mule board game is actually not a bad idea, at least. I don't really know mule very well because it didn't exist as far as I know. Did it exist on the Apple II? I don't think it did.
No, I don't think so.
But, Jack, do you know it?
Yeah, I played it a lot. It was on the Atari. It was on the Commodore 64. It's a lot of fun. I mean, it's a quite engaging game once you get into it. I mean, it's like it has elements of lots of like territory based board games, like say something like Risk. But then there's also a bit of real time stuff because you have to sort of have some. There's some reaction time things going on in there too. But I could definitely see how you could make it into a board game. I don't know if this is a good adaptation, but maybe.
It looks neat.
Looks neat.
Anytime I've heard people describe Mule, I always think of it that, wow, that sounds like that would make a great board game. I guess like a lot of sort of early real-time strategy games, like there's a lot of very board gamey elements to them. But it's kind of the canonical Atari game, right? Because it's, you know, four-player real-time. Like there was a whole bunch of stuff about it that really only the Atari can do it justice.
Right. Yeah, especially the four-player thing. That was when it really shined. I mean, two players was fun too, but when you got four people playing, it was really a blast because it combined the elements of playing a board game, which you're used to, and also a competitive, like, you know, on one screen together video game. So it was neat.
Mm-hmm. We should set it up at Kansas Fest one year. Just someone bring an Atari 400 or whatever with four joysticks and just show us all the light, as it were. It sounds like a great experience. Atari people all go on and on about how great it is, and so many of us have never played it.
Yeah, let's call their bluff.
Exactly. That's right. No, that was exactly what I was going to say, too. I think that whenever I hear about it, I hear people loved it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like, you know, people's favorite memories from their childhood.
And it's one of these things where I think playing once through a game takes an hour, hour and a half, that kind of thing. So it's not really a quick game. It's like, you know, it's like playing, you know, Risk or whatever. Well, Risk can take longer than that, but it takes some time to get through it. And there's some randomness to it, and there's some there's a bit of Hunt the Wumpus in there, and there's a lot of like interesting stuff that happens and weird things you can't predict. And there's an economic simulation in there as well, and you can decide, two players can decide to collude with one another and fix their prices together when they're buying and selling resources. So it's pretty interesting.
Well, it would certainly fit in well. It's interesting how the last few years at KFest, there's been kind of a weird old board game thread going. So we played the Lode Runner game. We played Fublitsky one year. Recently, a bunch of you played. What was that one you guys were playing on the 2C in the lobby with the cards and the robots? Robot Rascals.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. So that one. So yeah, this would definitely be another one of those in the line that we should try.
Yeah, although the fact that it takes an hour means that that's not a virtual Kansas Fest activity. That's a real one.
Yes. Yeah.
And I suppose maybe, you know, as homework or preparation, you can get the board game and practice.
That's right.
I wonder, there's a way to do board games. I forget now what is that system called? There's a system that people use to play kind of like board games remotely.
Right. Like Tabletopia or something?
Oh, yeah, we played Star Saga 1 that way.
Yeah, right. I forget what it's called.
Yeah. Sorry, Michael. Michael Sternberg did a Kansas Fest talk on how to do this, too. It'll come to me at some point. But anyway, when you're done thinking about the Loadrunner board game and buying the Mule board game, you can spend the rest of your time looking around on eBay. Carrington has some suggestions for us.
I do indeed. Here, let me share something. Okay, so my first choice, what I'm going to do, actually, I've put together a little theme. Let's imagine you want the ultimate 80s desk. I'm going to give you some things to put on the desk. Yeah, you can buy a desk. You can pick a vintage computer to put on it. But I'm talking about the things that will surround that. So my first choice is you're going to pick up this little auction here. Buy it now for $60. It comes with a tie and a little plaque. Forget the tie. We don't care about the tie. Tie is cool. It's an Intel tie, blah, blah, blah. Everyone's like, no, I want you to pick up this little plaque. So the plaque here is an I Love Computers plaque from the 1980s. 1985 Hallmark cards. It says, I love computers. I can sit and watch them do my work for hours. I love that kind of dad joke. It's awesome. This is I just know that this I can imagine people having this on their desk in the 1980s. So this is how you're going to start. You're going to have this little computers are awesome. They'll do your work for you with a little hand-drawn thing. Kind of looks like a Kathy cartoon, and it's got a printer just spewing out lots of printed stuff. This is how you're going to do your this is for you, Paul. I want you to change your desk at school when you go to school. So you're going to begin with this. You're going to get rid of all your collection completely. You're going to start with this. Okay. So first is this plaque. It's going to cost you $60 for this plaque, but it's worth it for the overall experience. Our second item you're going to purchase is this one. So our second item is a little tiny pencil holder with dirty jokes on it. 1980s computer dirty jokes. They're not even like that dirty, but it's stuff like the software is too hard, your hardware is too soft, a warning, like make sure you turn it on first. So you just know there's a certain type of person, certain type of dude who would have just thought this was great to have on his oppressive desk in the 1980s. And so if you want to be that person, Paul, which I think you do,
I would like nothing more than that.
This is your second item. It's only $20, $19.19. So I think the person who priced this as $19.19 is probably the person who had this on their desk from the very beginning. This is this person's thing, and they're finally willing to let it go. So it's a pencil holder, even pencils. Remember pencils, kid? So the pencils. So you're going to have a pencil holder. And then you're going to have two more items, two more tchotchkes that are going to complete the look for you. And the first of them is this little thing here. It's a 1980s stained glass computer program software coder at desk. It's $40. Handmade. I adore it. It's out of little bent pieces of metal.
I like that.
Right? You could just imagine a person who had some skills welded this, put it together, and this was the way they were expressing their art. And I adore this thing. I just think it's great. Little bits of stained glass.
That's beautiful.
Bent metal, massive little tiny printouts from the computer. And I can just see somebody would have this on their desk or in the credenza. Remember credenzas? They're going to have a credenza behind them, and it's going to have this thing. And I love it. I just absolutely adore it. I was glad it was still available on eBay. No one snatched it up from when I was going to pick it last episode. So, Paul, you're going to have this stained glass desk, 1980s. I adore this thing. But more importantly, we're going to add to it from a different seller, totally different seller, this piece, clearly made by the same person. It's a business card holder with stained glass and bent metal and all these little books on it. So clearly the same person made both of these. So I started thinking like, okay, come on. Were these like – they look like something just some dude would make. But they must have been mass-produced. So I started thinking like – what is up with this? Well, it turns out I found where these things were sold, and it was a place called Adele's 2 in Encino, California. And we're going to have a link to that. The fact that in 2007, it closed down. It had been operating for 32 years. It was a little gift store, and they sold lots of gifts, including locally made things. I guess either – I don't think the business owner, but the business owner of that store – was the father of the guy who became a TV producer and produced Fear Factor. So the Fear Factor's producer's dad in Encino, California, had a little gift store, and they sold these things, and two different people on eBay are selling the two different items, and I just totally love it. So you are going to have, Paul, you're going to have the greatest 1980s desk at your school. Your office is going to be just full of these little welded metal pieces with stained glass that I just adore. And you're going to have a story behind them as well. You tell everybody about the Fear Factor guy.
That's right.
So the Encino connection makes this last one make more sense now. It's show business card holder. Mm-hmm. Show business. So as in, if you're in show business, you have this on your desk.
Yeah.
So that's why the little guy...
I read that wrong. I thought it was like show your business card. I'm like, I didn't even understand. Yeah,
no,
show
it's
business,
like card holder for show business. So that's show why business. He's got variety on his desk.
Right.
And he's got a script there and like it's show businessy stuff. Yeah. And he's on the phone like he's an agent or whatever.
Yeah. So there you go. Closed down 2007. But I love the fact that it's two different sellers from two different, completely different areas are both selling a piece. And the second one, the one selling this one, said they bought it originally from this place. And so I'm like, okay, where is that place? And so we'll have a link to, unfortunately, it closed down 2007, so a few years ago, but after 32 years. I just love all these little pieces. So rather than picking computers, we're going to pick stuff you would have on your desk along with computers in the 1980s. So those are my choice. A little theme group. You're going to spend a few $100, Paul, but it's going to be worth it.
Excellent.
Brilliant.
Okay, I guess I am next. So I have a bunch of random stuff as I always do. And I think, okay, so the way I usually pick these things is that, they're, you know, like there's something to say about it. Cause most of the time they're going to all be closed. You know, like the auctions will have ended by the time the thing actually gets posted. But, so the first one I had, when I first picked it, it hadn't already been, bought, but it's, an Apple II game called Brimstone, and it's an electronic novel. And I actually am not quite sure what the game part of it is, but it's some sort of combination book and software. And so it actually has a book. I mean, like, I do in fact have this book, and it's big, big-ish. You know, I'm holding up my fingers in a big-ish way. and so, you know, there's something to read, and then there's something to play. But also, this particular one is new and sealed and graded. And so the little notation I had put by this was essentially like, Brimstone and the Terribleness of the World. Because, you know, it sort of seems like I really don't like this whole grading thing. and I think we've complained about that before. But anyway, this is a graded, thing. It says it's a brand new game. It's been sealed inside a hard acrylic case and graded 80x100 by the Video Game Authority. But I don't actually know. After that, it says, I did not get a grader's report from this game, but I feel the pictures do a good job of showing its condition. So, like, the world is getting worse and worse as we read through this description. Because the game could exist graded, and here are some photos of a graded one, but yet I think maybe this auction was for one that isn't the one in the photos.
Oh, goodness.
It's just that it's about as good as the one in the photos. Or something. Anyway, 10 people bid on it and spent the winning bid was $78. And
I think this is what Jimmy Mars talked about this on Digital Antiquarian. I think it's what they call bookware. So it was sort of like interactive fiction, but even less interactive. And it was one of those things that was, again, supposed to be the next wave of media or whatever, and then it just fizzled.
Yeah, there was Synapse, which did this one. They have one called Mind Wheel, which is, I think, the more readily available, maybe more famous one. That's the one that comes up quite a bit, I see. But there was also a few Star Trek books that were Apple II games. They'd come with the book and one called Essex, I think. So there were a few of these things. But Quinn's right. It kind of was a dead-end thing. It never really went anywhere.
I think that maybe – I think you may have listed all of the ones this series is Synapse Broderbund. And I think Essex and – the wheel one and Brimstone are the only ones.
One of my favorite Apple II games is Portal, which is sort of a really just you read it, but it didn't come with a book, although there is a novel, but it was a novelization of the game. It's not really a game that is a novel. Yeah. So
you can't buy that, but I wouldn't have suggested buying it anyway. The existence of the thing is kind of interesting. And I'm pretty sure some of these things are scanned by now. I thought I'd seen somebody scan Essex at least. But if they haven't, you know, if I ever get back to my office, then maybe I will scan mine. Here's another one that it wasn't ended when I put it on the list yesterday, but it is now ended. And I guess somebody bought it for $100. But it is Aristotle. Aristotle menu software. And I thought this was interesting. It says it's an Apple-produced thing. It says, you know, Apple II Aristotle menu software. I think it's interesting just because I almost never come across this. I mean, like, I think I have seen this once before, but it is, to me, it is not a famous thing. Is this famous to any of you?
I've never heard of this, ever.
No.
Yeah, and so I always find it interesting when I see something that's got, like, the real Apple, you know, like, branding on it and all this stuff. You know, it's clearly just one of their software packages, but it's a title I just don't know.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've never heard of this. It looked like it was something related to their work groups thing. What was that called? Where you had a bunch of Apple IIs all networked together sharing an image writer. There was something in the first photo, I think, on the...
Oh, okay.
Anyway, Apple had some, like, with Apple Talk and so on, there was that, like, work groups thing that they had for a little while.
There's Apple work groups server.
Yeah,
but there
like you put a workstation card in each Apple II, and then they could share an image writer. And this seems to be menu software for that, maybe. And that might be why nobody's heard of it, because it was specific to that.
But I've seen mentioned schools and teachers here. Like, it's something school specific.
Yeah, I think this was part of the whole Apple II workstation setup that never really went anywhere.
Yeah, okay. I'm attempting to read the text on the back. You know, it does seem like it is kind of like a school network based thing.
Yeah, it's like the hardware requirements include like local talk or a workstation card or an Apple IIgs or various other things that, yeah. Mm-hmm. So this would be like late, probably like 91, something like that, or 90.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, just it's always surprising to me when I can see something that has a real official Apple logo on it, and I don't know it, you know, and it doesn't look that different from the other things that I do know. So anyway, somebody else also thought it was interesting and bought it. So once again, you cannot buy it.
Foiled again.
Yeah. The next thing I had is it's just a little thing. It's a Novation Cat, an acoustic coupler. I sort of think of these as these are kind of like the canonical microcomputer acoustic couplers. This is the actual thing. The Novation company made the Cat, but they also let a couple of different companies brand these as well. So I think you can get a Radio Shack version of this, you know, that's a Novation Cat, but with Radio Shack on it. And, I have one with Apple on it, although those were really not very common, but there is an Apple branded one, a badged one of these. Did any of you actually have to use one?
I never did.
I never used an acoustic coupler.
Okay. It's fortunate to never have to.
I had a very understanding school district, I guess. because there was a summer, I know I've talked before about having borrowed the North American BBC Micro for summer, but I also, before my family got that first Apple II Plus, they let me borrow I think I may have borrowed a Bell and Howell, actually, but I borrowed a school 2 plus for a while, and I borrowed an acoustic modem. So I was able to dial into like the news wire and read the newspaper in the morning or whatever. It was pretty cool. 300 baud.
Yep.
So the closest I ever got to this was my very first modem, which was 1200 baud. I did have to unplug the phone and plug it into this because we didn't have separate phone lines in the house. So it was, you know, back when you had to rent the phone from the phone company. And so the phones were actually hardwired into the wall.
Right.
So
right.
To plug in your modem, you unplugged it from the phone and then plugged in the modem. Yeah. And then the modem had to be licensed because there was a legal ruling that hadn't happened yet where you weren't allowed to plug anything into the phone lines at all because it was all considered their property. Yeah. It was crazy times.
Good old battle
days.
The good old bad old days.
Yeah. Let's see. I found a couple of bags on, and maybe I'll mostly skip over. This one kind of jumped out at me as being just another of these situations where I don't think the seller really knows quite what this is. You know, they said official Apple logo canvas computer equipment bag. And what it is the bag that you carry around the Mac 128K in. It's like the original Macintosh bag. But they don't know what it is. It's just some bag that has an Apple on it. And so they're selling it for $20. I guess it's for $50, or you could bid for $20. But I think if you get this for $20, that's you've gotten a good deal. Though they are often pretty grungy, I have to say. This one doesn't look too bad, but there's something about them that they attract grunginess.
I know the feeling.
Yes.
The Carrington Vanston story.
And, part of my rationale for picking that was that it seemed cheap to me, but then the alternative one that is actually labeled properly, has one bid and it's $10, which is half the price of the one I thought was cheap. So if nobody else bids, then this one was even better.
Yeah, both seem cheap to me. Like,
yeah.
If I had one of those to carry around, I'd love to have one of these bags to carry it in.
Yeah.
If I was going to take my classic Mac somewhere.
That's right, as you do. That's right. And then there was a similarly, I think, fairly cheap Mac portable bag. And in action, too, there's a nice blurry photo.
Why even post that photo?
Yeah.
Because you're going to be on the go. It's kind of showing you. Like,
that's true. That's right. It's portable. But the thing about these are actually kind of nice. They are form fit for the portable. And the thing that is 100% true of everyone I've ever seen is that they do not have all 4 feet. At least one, if not two, if not all four of the feet have fallen off of everyone, and this one is no exception.
You just have to buy 4 bags.
Yeah. I think I have 2 bags, but I certainly don't have 8 feet between them.
This just in, Paul has 2 bags, but not 8 feet.
That's right. Okay. I think I won't bother with that since it's not for sale. I think the last one I will mention, I don't think we talked about this here, but there was a little conversation that happened about this at some point. This is an auction for 3 Disk 2 drives. And so these are for the Apple II. They're somewhat unremarkable. The top in this little pyramid of drives that's in the picture is missing some of the badging. And it's actually, I didn't realize this for a long time, but on the Disk 2, if people can picture this disk drive, it has a little Apple in the right corner, and it says Disk 2 and has a little in-use thing that points to an LED in the left. But it turns out that all that stuff that isn't, just black, is part of a just sort of like a sticker that you put on the front. So the sticker has a little hole that the LED pokes through, and it just basically covers the bottom of a very standard, otherwise 5 1/4 inch drive. And I always thought that these were sort of like specially made drives or whatever, but it turns out, these stickers are separate. You could get them in repair kits,
I didn't know that. When you're handling it, it feels like they're like embossed. Like it doesn't seem like a sticker.
Well, they are three dimensional. But even still, they stick out.
It feels like it's all like it's been molded into the front of the drive. Yeah, like it doesn't seem like a sticker to me. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I did not. It was like 6 years ago or something that I learned this fact. I did not know this in the 80s.
It was six seconds ago that I learned it. So.
I can beat that. When I was a kid, I had a Disk 2. For my Apple, my first Apple II, I had a single Disk 2. And I assumed it was okay that it's working, even though I've got Disk 2, but I don't have Disk 1. I assumed that it was supposed to be, this was supposed to be the second one.
I
didn't
know.
Disk 2. I didn't, Apple II, Disk 2. I didn't put those together. I just thought, I've got a Disk 2. Why don't I have a Disk 1?
Yeah. Meanwhile, the main thing that sort of made me want to pick this is that if you look at the back of these drives, it turns out they're from 2 different eras, and the one on the top is from a newer era. I mean, they made millions of these drives. The serial numbers on the bottom ones, they're high. One is about 1.4 million. One is about 600,000. So they made a lot of these drives. The serial number on the top is actually 2 million. Somewhere along the line, so on the back, there's a big thing that says basically, warning, only connect this to the Disk 2 interface card. It says this in English, connect this cable only to the Apple Disk 2 interface card. And there's a little arrow pointing to the cable that you're supposed to be careful about. And then later on, they I guess they didn't like the Englishness of that, you know, that you had to speak English to understand this. And so they sort of, they changed it to icons. And so there's a little warning here. And I
don't know that I would understand that warning.
That iconography makes no sense.
It is the funniest thing I've ever seen. There's no way that you can understand what that means anymore. It's got a picture of a disc and an arrow and a warning, you know, triangle and an Apple II in a rectangle. And I think what it means is you plug this disc into the card. I think that rectangle with the Apple II in it is a card inside your Apple II.
Okay.
And the arrow points to the cable that has to go into that card. Anyway, you kind of have to see this to understand just how nonsensical this warning is.
Restrained metaphors there.
Yeah, that's objectively worse than the English one, even if English is not your first language. I'm sorry. Apologies to non-English speakers, but that is not better.
So apparently Susan Kerr didn't work for Apple at this stage.
Yeah. No.
Like later she looks at it, so what are you guys doing? Hey, let me redo your icons.
Yeah.
I can't understand that label at all.
No, it makes no sense. It makes no sense at all. So I thought that was sort of funny, and that's actually the only reason I picked this auction is because it had that label on the back of the drive. And I think that was the end of the auctions that I wanted to pick. But this time I am not at the end of the alphabet, so... Quinn, you have the next ones.
Okay, yes. Let me see if I can share my screen here. I'm new to this live streaming thing here.
Noob.
Michael is here.
Hey, Michael.
And Michael has joined us late in the game.
A wild Michael appears.
So we started recording 2 hours ago. Is that magic?
Yes, I was asleep 2 hours ago.
Okay.
You have come up earlier in the episode, though.
That's right.
No, I misread the email. I had the end of the block saying times are changing, blah 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 blah, Sydney 0800. So I set the alarm and went to bed.
Oops. Oh, okay. I'm just going to talk about Quinn's eBay auctions, and if you had a couple that you wanted to put in, you're welcome to join.
He's just here to say retrocompute.
Yeah, I've always got auctions. Pandemic notwithstanding, I'm still even looting and pillaging the United States and having stuff shipped over.
Get it while you can.
Yeah. Also, technically, Michael, you were supposed to come in before Paul. We're doing it alphabetical. You're too late.
It's okay.
Wow, harsh.
I'll just go back to scanning a 1938 copy of Mechanics and Handicrafts.
Yes, as one does.
All right, so for my eBay items, I wanted to share a mild obsession I have, which is with the Apple IIc carrying bags. Now, I did not realize when I chose this that Paul had also a very bag-themed list of items, but interestingly, these IIc bags are exactly opposite from the Macintosh bags in several key ways, one of which is that these are almost never grungy. There's something about these Apple IIc carrying bags where a whole lot of people bought them and nobody ever used them. And I think that maybe...
No, that's wrong. The Apple IIc is just perfect.
Yeah. I think dust doesn't dare touch it. No, I think my theory on this is that everybody bought it because, it's a portable computer, right? This is going to be great. And then realized that, you have to carry the monitor with you and also you have to plug it in when you get where you're going. So it's actually not at all portable. It just has a handle on it that is never going to get used. So I think a lot of people bought these bags and they sat in closets for 40 years and now they're all on eBay. Now, what the other very interesting thing about these bags is that they seem to be in this, strange place in the market where nobody understands what they are. And so they're almost all massively, massively undervalued. And if people kind of knew what they were, I think they would be worth a lot more money. Now, I've seen these things for as little as $10. I think I paid $20 for mine. The two that I found here today, unfortunately, are more than that. But if you have the right search terms, you can find them. I found these two because I found them the easiest way possible because I didn't plan ahead. And that's to use the search phrase vintage Macintosh case because universally everybody thinks they're the Macintosh, something related to Macintosh, of course. So the word vintage, of course, is going to find all the overpriced ones. But if you search for like old or unknown or weird Mac bag, like weird old Mac case or things like that, then you'll find all the ones where people don't know what they are and they're $10. So That's one key to these things. The other interesting thing about them is that there's two variants. There's one where the logo is in the upper left corner, and then there's one where the logo is in the lower right corner. And the lower right corner ones are more rare. I don't know why, but if you are an aficionado of these bags, you've just learned something. So things to watch for, again, quality or condition, I've never found one that's in bad shape, honestly. I'm sure they're out there, but they all seem to be in surprisingly excellent condition, again, because I think none of them were ever used. but you do want to go through the pictures and, let's see here, the two things that are, common problems. So this one that I have here is, $80. It's missing the strap, which is annoying. It is showing in one picture. Okay. So this one has the strap. Sometimes they are missing the strap because it was unbuckleable and therefore sometimes is gone. The other common thing that's missing often is inside one of the compartments. One of the two internal compartments is supposed to have a little cover over it, and it's kind of hinged. So I think it's not clear to me the exact way you were supposed to put the 2C in this thing, but I think this cover was for the power supply, and it has a little corner cut out of the cover so that the cord could escape from the compartment and you could leave the power supply in there, I think.
Keep things warm.
Yeah, exactly. Keep it nice and toasty. And then I think the other little corner was for the mouse. So these internal dividers are sometimes missing because they snap in and out. You can see in this photo there's little snaps there. So that is often missing. And then the little cover has often been torn off on the one compartment. So those are things to watch for. But yeah, I have two here. This one's $80. It's complete. I have another one here that is $58, and it is missing the internal lid that I just mentioned, but is otherwise in good condition. So as I say, if you watch a little bit, you won't have to wait very long. These come up really, really cheap because nobody knows what they are, but you won't ever find it by searching for Apple IIc carrying bag. or if you do, it's going to be overpriced. But yeah, because people don't know that the Apple II ever existed, these things are all really, really cheap. So.
And if you have an Apple IIc that you're not using all the time, it's a great way to store it and keep it dust-free and stuff and everything together.
That is exactly what I use mine for. I use it for storage of my Apple IIc and for carrying it to KFest and back. It's really perfect for that. And it's a very nice bag. It's Apple, and they made stuff nicely, and it's very well made. So it's padded and everything. It's got little storage for floppy disks, and you can, all the cables and everything fit. And there's just enough extra space that you can also fit, like, your SD card floppy emulator in there. It fits. I keep the Plamen VGA adapter in there. Everything fits in there really nicely. So, and it's all padded and everything. So I actually carry it on the plane as luggage the way it was intended to be used, and it works great. So I love these bags. I'm, like I said, mildly obsessed with them, but they're surprisingly inexpensive because nobody knows what they are.
Yeah, I've got a couple of those along with the Macintosh portable bags, and that's what I use for lugging all my stuff around to meetups. So they're very handy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had an auction. I realized I skipped one. I was wondering, why did I skip that one? The auction that I did not include was a sort of miscellaneous Apple II Plus, I think, with a bag, but the bag was the Apple III bag. Those are relatively uncommon, but, that one I would love to bring on a plane. I do have one here that I used to bring in the Apple III home, when I brought it from my office, but it is, it's big, it's heavy. You can tell that the Apple III one, you can tell because it actually has a shoulder strap, because you'd injure yourself if you were not using the shoulder strap.
Yeah, the Apple II leatherette bag, that's another one that gets strange looks when you take it onto the plane.
Mm.
Honestly, the Apple IIc, too, like when it's fully loaded in there with the power supply and everything, it's pretty heavy. Like, you wouldn't want to carry it very far, honestly. The Apple IIc seems very light, but when you put all the cables and the power supply and everything in there, yeah, you wouldn't want to carry it a lot.
Yeah, the good thing about carrying something like the Apple II around in the bag is that you can pop the lid off the Apple II itself and then put more stuff inside the Apple II. That's where I used to put all my manuals and spare cables and other stuff. The trick is to put the power cable in there so you can't accidentally start it up with the contents that aren't actually computer related.
Yeah. Smuggling tips for Michael.
Oh, look, magic smoke and leaping flames.
Yeah. Three kilograms of sugar fit inside there. Don't ask me how I know that.
Now, the other strange one is going around an airport where you've got the luggage on rollers and with the strap. And I was moving through Denver Airport, and my luggage was somewhat overweight because I'd been plundering the secondhand bookstores in Boulder, being a university town. Mm-hmm. And got there, and I had strange looks from the security guards as I was dragging, and almost looked like, you know, if I'd come downhill, I'd be like dragged behind the suitcase as it ran away. But once they saw that it was just an Australian guy with about 75 pounds worth of paperback books, they were most understanding.
Excellent.
Not smuggling gold bars, just a nerd.
Yeah. Nerd on the loose. Send him home.
All right. Well, it's interesting that we recorded for so long that Michael, being two time zones away from the intended recording time, still managed to make it before the end.
I caught up to him.
Yeah. I even have an eBay item if you can fit me in. But
oh yeah, sure. Why not?
So down the back of the plane, this one, there's still 7 available. I've just received mine, and it basically allows you to – it's meant for a car reversing camera. So in my case, I'm going to be plugging a retro computer into the composite and then plugging, obviously, some power into it, seeing I won't have a conveniently placed car to hook into the brake power, light power. And then you download the app for your tablet or phone, and that will play back the composite signal. So basically, it's going to be a portable monitor for various species of retro devices.
That's interesting. I'm very curious to see how well that works.
So it has its own little network for hooking into. And yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. I've seen one that's actually been set up for the Apple II, plugging into the cable at the back so that it actually picks up the power and the composite signal all on the one socket. But I'm going to make mine a little bit more universal because I've got, as I said, many species of retro device. And I just want to make it so that I can just have a breakout box for it and just plug in the appropriate ends, because some of them have their own devil spawned connectors and whatnot. So I just want to try and make it fairly universal. But I figured that this might be a handy bit for some of our other listeners if they're after something interesting. The next thing I want to do with it is then to airplay that signal back to, say, a slightly larger 60-inch or so plasma display. So
the word lag comes to mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now 6 seconds behind.
Is this why you were so late? Are you actually using it right
He's
now?
Using this thing, yeah. It's 2 hours behind.
Okay, my question is, do you know if it supports the 15 kilohertz RGB? Like, will it work with old computers?
Well, as I said, someone's already had it hooked up to an Apple IIc, and okay. They're saying that the lag is actually quite low. But I think once you start putting too many bitses in between the device and your ultimate screen, things might start getting a bit different. I'm not a real-time game player, so wizardry and spreadsheeting and...
Everything's real-time if you're slow enough. Infocom games are real-time to me.
Oh, no. That's almost like a first-person shooter, isn't it? A text adventure?
Yeah, I connected my Apple III through a couple of devices at a certain point. You know, it went like to a composite HDMI converter, and then to an HDMI capture, and then into OBS, and then onto my screen, and it was amazing how it was like 20 seconds behind. It was just unbelievably hard to use. This does seem pretty cool, though.
I guess this can't be too bad because it's designed for a backup camera in your car, so. Like, the delay would have to be, like, less than a second, I would hope.
Right. Oops, sorry.
Well, that was one of the reasons I was expecting it to have so like an acceptable lag in that. So, yeah.
That child is still 2 seconds away. It's fine.
Yeah. You got to lead them a little if you want to hit them.
If you want to get them.
So that's all I've got. The rest in my watch list at the moment is a whole pile of old books and other bits and pieces.
Cool. All right. Well, I guess now we've made it through the eBay auctions, and we can talk about closing notes, closing discussions.
Well, Michael's here, so I think it's just shift change. So the show keeps going. We just bring on new hosts.
Right. Right.
Now it's Michael and Blake, and yeah.
Just rotate.
If you want to, as your closing notes, to talk about your second computer, that's perfectly fine.
Let's make this episode a perfect loop.
Okay. Well, my second computer was in 1993, and we came into some money, and I bought myself a DX2, well, actually bought the parts and assembled a DX266 with 8 meg of RAM. It was running DOS, Windows 3.1.1, and it was a beautiful machine. And that was my introduction to the dark side of computing, because up till then I had been using my original Apple IIc on a 9-inch monitor, and my eyesight was not really up to the 9-inch monitor anymore. So I decided if I was going to get one of those massively large 14-inch monitors that I was going to get a new computer to go with it. So, it was a good machine. It got upgraded. It finished its service to the household as a Windows 2000 machine running a 21-inch Philips Triniton monitor with massively more than the original 730-megabyte hard drive. So it was a good workhorse. I kept the board, the CPU and the RAM. The case went off ages ago, so that's another one of my little projects is just to do a shadow box of that board with just a selection of cables and other bits in it so that it'll live on. But, my God, RAM was expensive back then. when it was originally priced, it was $50 a megabyte, I timed it just good enough, accepting the quote, because the dealer said that if I'd put the order in one day later, the price jumped up to $83 a megabyte. Mm-hmm. Good times. Yeah.
What I found funny was you said your second computer was from the mid-90s. I thought, how young are you?
Yeah.
My second computer, we were just banging rocks together.
No, I bought my Apple IIc in 84 and was using it actively right up until when I bought the DOS Windows machine in late 93. So I got some good service out of the old Apple IIc, but I was at that stage just looking to change what I was doing. And also I needed something to connect into the office for working from home. Second line had gone in, and I just couldn't find any workable remote access software from the approved suppliers list for an Apple II computer.
Yeah.
Surprising.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, my second computer was basically second phone line and second office, I suppose you could say, for working from home. So there was that'll give us the 222.
Perfect.
All right. Carrington, any closing thought?
I have thoughts. Oh, I think I mentioned in a previous episode, my girlfriend and I, she got mentioned. We've been doing
she's
a lot
not
of
real.
Online.
Wait, she's not real. From Canada?
There's
I've been
Canada.
To Canada.
Totally real. she's been to Canada. Quinn's met all the people in Canada.
Yeah. I go to the meetings. She's not there.
With a hand out the maple syrup. We've been playing a lot of escape rooms online. And
you still can't get out.
No, we love them. And the nice, one of the nice things, the only nice thing maybe about the whole fact we have to do everything online now is we're playing them in remote places. So we found a great set of games in Portugal. So lately we've been playing escape rooms in Portugal and they're awesome. So I'll find a link and put them in the show notes. So they're English based. It's a bunch of Brit expats that run it. So if you want to play a really good escape room that's done like intentionally virtually with great software support, I highly recommend this place. And it's in Portugal, so that's really cool. So I would link to that. But no vintage computer stuff, just escape rooms and probably not imaginary girlfriend. You don't know. You don't know. You judge my life.
Jack, any closing notes?
I don't have much retro computing stuff in my brain these days. I think I'm just focused on other stuff, like stuff. I don't know.
For example,
I'm playing a lot of music.
You like stuff.
Playing a lot of guitar and stuff. And then when I'm not playing guitar, I'm watching. This is kind of retro. It's not retro computing, and it's only slightly retro. I'm watching all of the Marvel MCU movies in order. I mean, it's kind of retro because they started 10 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. It's nostalgic in a way, even though it's not that long ago. I don't know. I got nothing.
Yeah, pretty soon we can have nostalgia for like the first RCR episode too, in that same way.
I have nostalgia for the beginning of this show. Remember way back when this episode started?
For Michael, it all felt like a dream.
Yeah, my old timers must be kicking in. It as if it never existed.
I also feel like I haven't done much like retro computing at all. I've done, I've done some podcast editing. I don't know if that counts, but and apparently not enough because there's still one that's unedited on my hard drive. But
That's retro.
Yeah, I have. So now we have an Australian here. Maybe this will. Although this maybe won't work. But I've been watching a lot of Rosehaven. Is that do you know Rosehaven? I've dived in a little bit to Australian TV, and some of it's pretty good. Like that, and
that was a backhanded compliment.
Yeah,
some of it's pretty good.
It's a bit different when you watch Australian TV and you're Australian because it's the usual cast.
Well, that's the thing. It seemed like it's sort of like British TV in that way. Like there's 13 people who act in everything.
Yeah, that's Canadian TV too. Yeah, yeah. It's the same 20 people and everything. Yeah.
But
and there are times I wish the US TV was like that too.
Yeah, but and I think
no, Rosehaven's not one I've been into.
Yeah, but the reason I got there was sort of from Utopia, which is one of these. It's in a sort of set of shows. I think I don't know how you pronounce his name, Rob Stitch. I don't know.
Stitch.
Yeah, but he seems to be well involved in these kind of like. Governmental dysfunction comedies.
They're not comedies; they're dramas.
Yeah, and there was a. It actually also reminded me of one from a longer time ago that I used to watch called The Games. But all of these are like they're funny and super frustrating. I don't know. Anyway, I enjoy them. That's what I'm doing.
He does bureaucracy very well. Yeah. Really takes the mickey out of it. No bureaucrat or politician is safe, and that is the way it should be. I think a lot more countries could really take a lesson from the way Australians treat their politicians. We've gone right past hatred. It's just down to total disdain and comedic material now.
Yeah. Oh, The Holloman. That was the other one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where Rob Stitch is now on the other side. But anyway, yeah. That's so if it's on, Netflix or somewhere other, it might be worth taking a look at. But Rosehaven is not, political. It's just sort of, but it's pretty charming. So.
Most of Australian TV is quite charming. Yeah. Except for when we're doing strange outback killers and things like that. Yeah.
Oh, Upright. That was the other one. I'd forgotten about that. But that's in a slightly different vein, that's Tim Minchin,
yep.
Doing more adult stuff. But
he's awesome.
Oh, he is.
Yeah. Anyway,
especially some of his satirical songs and things. Mm-hmm. George Pell, Come Home is one of my favorites. Look it up on YouTube, folks.
All right.
Okay. let's see. Who hasn't gone? Quinn hasn't gone.
I have not gone. Just in case it has gone unremarked thus far. We now have three of the four people who played the Loadrunner board game in the call.
So oh, yeah.
That's delightful. Almost got the full set. The only retro thing I've been doing is I've been trying to play my favorite video game, which is called Stronghold. And it's right in that difficult period. It's like 99-2000. So it's too new to emulate, but too old to run on anything anymore. And it was actually re-released on Good Old Games. You know, they do this thing where they take old games and they wrap them in a .NET wrapper and get them to run again on modern hardware, which is amazing.
Yeah. I love GOG,
yeah. Yeah, and so they re-released it. And so I got to play it again for about another 5 years. I play through the whole thing like once a year. I love it so much. It's a castle building game for anyone wondering. But so unfortunately, though, it was finally killed by Catalina because it was 32-bit. So now I'm once again without the ability to play that game. So I have an old Mac that I'm not going to upgrade to Catalina so that I can keep playing that game. And then I don't know what I'm going to do. So
that's amazing. Yeah. I've never even heard of this game before. So it's that good?
It is to me. It's just one of the things that pushed all my buttons. Like, it did fairly well. It wasn't a massive hit or anything, but it did well. But if you like that type of game, it's definitely the top of the genre, so to speak.
It's a RTS game. What kind of thing is it?
Yeah, it's RTS-y, but it's focused very much on defense. There's not really any offense, so it's a castle building game, which used to be a genre. You know, in the like late 80s, early 90s, into the mid 90s, that was kind of a genre, right? There was a bunch of Amiga games of that type, and where you're, you know, mining stone and laying out the walls and so on. So it's kind of like an RTS, except that it's all defensive and your success is very much down to how well you use the architecture to your advantage, basically. So you have to think about how you lay out your sight lines and place your towers and so on. So,
cool.
Yeah.
How do you defend yourself into someone else's territory that you want then?
So there's no like taking of territory. It's just like you build a castle and the game throws waves of enemies at you. It's sort of like tower defense nowadays, except more cerebral.
Okay, so not quite the way I play Civilization, where I assume the role of the minister for defense in other people's countries. So.
Yeah, there's really no offensive component to it, which is why I like it, because I actually don't like the offensive component of RTSs. Part of it never appealed to me. So that's an interesting thing. I have a similar problem with my second favorite game, which is Roller Coaster Tycoon. The original was written. It's a piece of genius that's, I think, rarely seen. Chris Sawyer wrote the entire thing in x86 assembly. And it's, you know, all the isometric graphics and everything he did himself. And it's absolutely incredible. But because of that, the original has never been ported to anything and never been redone because it's entirely an x86 assembly. And nobody's crazy enough to try and copy that. So it's been redone. Like, there was a 3D version and there was a sequel, but none of the subsequent versions of that brand are any good. Just the original was amazing, but the original runs on a very narrow window of PCs from a certain year, certain version of Windows. So again, for many years, I kept an old laptop in the closet that was in that window so that I could play it. Then that laptop broke and now I have no way to play it. So it's probably old enough now that you could emulate it, but it's also a gem, a moment in time.
Yeah. Well, speaking of games, before we get any closer to the end, I finally managed to buy a copy of my favorite game ever, and that was the original Computer Bismarck. So finally tracked that down. So, of course, the first thing I did was I scanned everything. the box lid, box sides, edges, manuals, inserts, all the bits and pieces, strat charts. I even scanned the floppy disk and the sleeve and loaded that up the Internet Archive. So there have been manuals and other things for that, but I believe this is the first complete set of all images. So if anyone wants that, just pop up to the Internet Archive and look for Computer Bismarck.
Other people may have scanned it, but this one's yours.
Well, yes. When I scan a game, I like to make sure that
it stays scanned.
Yes, that all the miscellanea that's inside the box, through the registration card and all the little little addendum pieces that if you don't pay attention to, you're going to screw up the game right. or you can't figure out how to get through somewhere. They go, oh, yes, this is how you actually fire the cannons on your ship.
If I remember right, this is one of the ones that had like a laminated card and like a little like grease pencil or something that came with it too.
Yeah, it came with the grease pencils, the laminated cards. sort of in that crossover period where not quite everything was being done on the computer, a bit like Neep River Line, which was the computer supplied the AI, but you actually had a map board and counters that you moved around to simulate the fog of war. So if you lost track of where the opposing units were, that could suddenly surprise you. In a nasty manner. But enough of that. We'll save that for another episode. Nasty surprises in games.
Excellent. I forget, where are we? I think we're done. Are we done?
Yep.
Okay.
I think so.
I could talk for hours.
Yeah.
I should have got here earlier.
Let's see. So as the time zone changes between now and next time, So I think next time you'll only be an hour late.
I'll be an hour late, so I'll set the alarm. I'll set the alarm for 9 a.m. so that I'll be my 2 hours late. Okay,
perfect. Excellent. Sounds good.
So next time, follow Paul's directions from the previous email, and everything.
Okay. Anyway, So this is even longer than before.
Sorry, folks.
No, it's okay. It's all fine. I was just thinking as I was finishing earlier, earlier today, I broke the 2 hour barrier on the editing of the previous episode. I was thinking, it's possible that maybe they shouldn't always all be over 2 hours long, but I think that's just the new reality we live in.
Yeah. I'll just a quick shout out to my background. This is actually a retro map of Australia. If I just move to the side, you'll see that we're missing a state. Which way? That way. There we are. The one in the middle is actually South Australia, which goes all the way through to the northernmost part of Australia. So thank you, Australia, for figuring that one out. But this is actually from a atlas that I got hold of, a 1868 Schillings Atlas, which I've also scanned. And the map of Australia, a little bit different. Basically, across the cutout corner of Queensland, just above my shoulder, from horizontally across there is basically above becomes the Northern Territory, which makes sense seeing it's the north of Australia. Mm-hmm. And below that line will be South Australia, which it currently is in this map, but makes more geographic sense. A map of North America is a real hoot because there's quite a lot of Canada's current provinces that don't exist in 1868 that right. are physically there but aren't there as a political entity.
I feel like you're attacking my girlfriend again.
And you would not recognize the map of Europe unless you're actually into that period of history. Quite a different thing. But
half of it is just Prussian Empire.
Yes, the Prussian Empire. Yeah, Prussians, the Russian.
That's cool.
Yeah, 1868, Canada, Confederacy was 1867. So, shortly before that, it was just North and South Canada. And, the English and the French just used it as a remote place to squabble.
It's also a British atlas, so they weren't overly concerned about being up to date about the colonies. So, what do you call those ones to the south of Canada? I keep forgetting their names. Merkins. Yeah, the Merkins.
It's a plague town is what we call it now.
Yeah. I know, it's on fire.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's just where the tea revenue comes in from.
Yep. It did. Yeah.
Too soon, Paul. Too soon.
Okay.
Been to Boston and just have a cup of harbor.
All right. Michael is like a fountain of energy, of course. Like having it's like a sub in a soccer game or whatever, right? They come in with their new fresh legs.
We're all exhausted. He's just busting in.
But nevertheless, I think we will probably close it down until 2 weeks from now. But But it's great that, Michael, that you could join us for the end here.
Oh, yeah. I'll give you a rundown of why I've been away for so long. That'll be an episode in itself, but yeah.
Excellent. Okay. There's here 223. But
I'm sure that represents one of the chemicals that I've been taking. Yeah.
Right. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast, where if you want to join, you should answer the questions so we know you are not a robot. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time,
Retro Compute!